couple of items for council members who have not handed Karen their committee selection sheets. Please make sure you get those done today, because it's something that we'll be working on pretty quickly. We have a full day of herring scheduled. We'll have our 90-minute breaks, and at the first 90-minute break, for those of you who are Red Sox fans, we will have grief counselors out in the hall. And I'm sure everybody knows Tom Brady cut his hair, too. So we got those two things out of the way. We will start on herring, so I will turn the meeting over to the herring chair, Doug Grau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you possibly read that fortune cookie again before we start today?
I used it up the other day.
Determination will get you through this.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Behind tab 5, you have all your herring information. I hope some of you actually used a CD for some of this information, as it was quite voluminous. I also want to, at the start, put in some kudos for the PDT and the amount of work and effort that they've put in on this. It's been quite a challenge for them, and I appreciate all the effort and time they've been putting in on it. We're going to be addressing two things today. First, we will be looking at the draft terms of reference for the 2012 benchmark stock assessment for herring, and providing comments on that. And secondly, of course, we're going to be considering approval of Amendment 5 draft EIS for public hearing and selection of preferred alternatives, if we choose to do that. There's a variety of information in your package that you probably should have available, beginning with the draft terms of reference. There's a presentation that that Lori's going to be giving on the amendment that was handed out this morning, as well as a report of the advisory panel and a decision document on Amendment 5. And, of course, hopefully on CD you've got Volume 1 and Volume 2 of the amendment. As I stated, I think the first thing that I'd like to have us review and provide comments on are the draft terms of reference for our the upcoming stock assessment. There's been some basic terms of reference provided, and then also the Science Center has also provided some suggestions. They include a lot of the standard items that you'll see on assessment, such as estimating the catch and present the survey data and coming up with reference, evaluating the reference points. So, Lori, did you want to say anything on it, or should we just go forward with council comments?
Well, hopefully everybody was able to look at the SSC comments as well. I believe the SSC report was a couple of days ago. And then there is a little bit of discussion in the Herring Advisors report. The advisors reviewed the terms of reference, and the one substantive comment that came from the advisors was just in emphasizing the need to clearly articulate in the assessment the relationship between fishing mortality and total mortality on the stock, and the contribution that fishing mortality makes relative to consumption and other sources of mortality. The advisors definitely supported a clear representation of that in the stock assessment so that everybody can understand how fishing mortality contributes to the total mortality on this resource.
So I'd ask counsel, do you have any comments on this?
Mary Beth.
I do have a question about number three, evaluate the utility of the number four, evaluate the validity of the current stock definition and determine whether it should be changed. Take into account what is known about migration among stock areas. And I guess it's a question for either Frank or Jim. Is there any new information on this? I mean, I'm not sure. It certainly is a big question for the assessment and how we manage the stock in general, but I'm not aware that we have anything new on that.
Jim.
Mary Beth, I don't know if we have anything new on that. The assessment scientists have the information, and they'll evaluate what we have. If there's nothing new, that will be basically described here. But if there is something new, they'll work with it. But I don't know the answer. Apparently, it was deemed to be important enough to list as a term of reference.
And then I guess the only other question I had about is about evaluating CPEU for this fishery. And in the past, the advice had been that it's really not a very good methodology for a schooling species like herring, availability, not available. And now it's a term of reference, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, in all of our stock assessments, the landings per unit of effort that's based on the commercial fishery, it can generally be computed, but it's often not clear what it means. And the intention of putting it here is to determine whether it is a valid index of abundance. So that's in some cases, assessment scientists dismiss landings per unit of effort because they'll say, oh, it's not meaningful because it's just reflecting management regulations. There may have been closed areas or trip limits and so forth. But the reason that it's included here is to explicitly have the assessment scientist state whether it's meaningful or not, and if it is, to consider using it. So this way they can't just dismiss it without writing something down to explain why.
Mary Beth.
And just one last thing. I noticed from the AP report that, this idea of the role of herring as forage and consumption is important, and I certainly agree with that recommendation. And it's interesting to me as we the analysis in this document, and we discuss the assessment, that we do place a priority goal and objective in the amendment, but we never talk about what the impact of stock size is on the ecosystem in general. I mean, herring is an important forage species, but it also eats a lot of stuff, particularly when your stock is high. And, for instance, herring compete with the same food source as right whales. And I don't know from your perspective if that has value in consideration in the assessment or not.
Well, I think it could have value. I think when we were drawing up the list of terms of reference, you can see that it's a fairly long list, and it has to, at some point, there is a cutoff for what can be included. And there are additional terms of reference that you could also include that are ecosystem related. But the one that people felt was most important to include was to look at the consumption of herring and then to see how that would change your estimate of natural mortality in the model. So that's the more important thing to consider in a single species stock assessment of herring.
Just like that, I agree with what Jim said, that we often look at the other side of what's eating herring and how they play their role they play in the ecosystem as food for someone else. But whether or not the ecosystem analysis is looking at how they compete for food with other species, especially marine mammals, is something that I assume because I'm not sure is considered. But that's a really much tougher issue to deal with. But it's considered as part of the terms of reference specifically. But it's a very difficult thing to deal with.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Jim on, put my glasses back on. Term of reference 8, about the existing model and the should a new model be developed. The last assessment, when it came out, there was a lot of discussion and presentations to the committee as well as the full council about the outcomes of the last stock assessment, its sensitivity to different inputs and configuration, the addition of new data or not. And it seems to me I remember seeing a fairly elaborate or schedule of should a new model be developed, how far it could go, and if we went this route, it would take a long time, and we wouldn't be able to include this set of trawl data. But if we only went one advance forward, it could be done in a more timely fashion. This term of reference doesn't seem to capture that, and I wondered where that stands. Is there going to be a new model developed? If so, how far of an advance is it going to be, and who makes that decision? Is it up to the working group to bring whatever they bring to the table, and that's what it is, or is there some guidance to them as to where to go next with it?
Yeah, the working group has the freedom here to go as far as they want to in developing a new model. Of course, that might be rejected by the reviewers. So the intent is to have them also use the last previously accepted model and update it with new data so that's a fallback position for determining stock status. But most of their focus will be on developing a new model if they choose to do that. If they don't have a new model, they'll simply work with the model that they had before and maybe try to improve it. But in a lot of cases, it seems that they've been moving towards new models. We'd have to really bring in the assessment scientist. I'm not sure what they're planning.
Dave Pierce.
On number 2, there's a reference to the survey data being used in the assessment, the regional indices of abundance. We now use the Bigelow as opposed to the Albatross. I cannot recall if the center has been able to determine calibration factors for sea herring, so my question would be, should there be a term of reference that would pertain to those calibration factors, a term of reference along the lines of reexamining the calibration factors to see if indeed they are a way for us to convert the Albatross data to Bigelow data for purposes of the assessments? Kind of an open-ended question here. If the calibration factors have already been provided, then I guess they'll use them, and then they must have confidence in them. But if not, I'd like to see a focus on those calibration factors because they are so critical for our use in survey data. So I guess that's the question to Jim regarding where we stand with those calibration factors and should we include them as part of a term of reference?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to add. I think it's implied in here already that it's asking for them to look at the indices of abundance, and any index of abundance that's on this list is going to be scrutinized, and there will be a lot of caveats about whether or not it should be used and so forth. So I think it's all implied within number 2, if you want to send a comment, you know, asking that that be written out, we'll consider it. But in my opinion, I think they're already going to do it.
I just wanted to be assured that indeed that is going to be covered, because if it isn't, then we'll end up with some questions at the end of the process that will be difficult, if not impossible, to answer. So I don't know the best way to do this, Mr. Chairman, except to indicate to the center that we assume that this work regarding survey data being used in the assessment will also factor in an evaluation of the calibration factors and their usefulness.
Well, from what I heard from the center was that your assumption is valid.
Okay. I'm comfortable with that.
Any further suggestions, comments from council members on the herring TORs? I will go to the public for a couple of comments on this. Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the council. Turn it back over to you, Doug.
Thank you very much, and thanks for those comments. So let's move on to Amendment 5, Draft EIS. I think the first thing I'd like to do is turn it over to Lori for a presentation on the document. We also had an advisory panel meeting last week, and due to the fact that the chair and vice chair were unable to attend, I had to chair it, so I'll be providing you with the AP report here after Lori's presentation and after any questions that people may have of the document of Lori. Okay, does that sound like a plan? Take it away, Lori.
Okay. Thank you. We did distribute the presentation slides this morning, so everybody should have a copy of them. I apologize for forgetting to put the page numbers on the presentation slides. That's usually helpful since there's so many of them, so sorry about that. We also distributed this morning a color decision document that Talia put together. Big thank you for that work from Talia, which I think after the presentation will be a good reference document for you guys. That's the one that's all color-coded. So I'm going to go ahead and in just a couple of minutes summarize the entire document for you and all of the analysis that's in it. I will try to move quickly, and at the end of the presentation, if you have any specific questions on any elements of the analysis, I would be happy to address them. I'm going to kind of go over things in a more general sense in the presentation. The first slide here is a reminder of the goals and objectives of Amendment 5. I'm not going to read the entire slide to you, but as we started this amendment when it was Amendment 4, and we split it into Amendment 5, the overall goal is to develop an amendment to improve catch monitoring and ensure compliance with the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And then we have identified four objectives underneath that. Following the goals and objectives of Amendment 5, the committee and the council approved goals and objectives specific to the catch monitoring program that would be developed in this amendment. And those are listed on the next slide here with the gray shading. These are also in your decision document. There's four goals for the catch monitoring program with several objectives. At this point, I would like to just take a minute and recognize the major contributors to this document in the Herring Plan Development Team members. I have listed most of them on this slide. I am terribly sorry to have forgotten probably the most important contributors to the document, which are the folks from the Observer Program. Amy Van Atten, Sarah Weeks, and Debbie Duarte have been incredibly helpful in terms of going through all of the Observer data and helping us with all of the information and analysis in the document. Also, big thank you to the Science Center, Maine DMR, Massachusetts, and the regional office for all of their help and contributions to this document. This was a huge undertaking and a very collective effort on all of our behalf. So thank you to everybody. Now, if you recall, the alternatives for this amendment were approved in January by the council, and at the time we approved them, some of the alternatives were still kind of vague and somewhat conceptual. So a lot of the work that occurred after the January council meeting, before we could even really get into the analysis, was fleshing out the details of the alternatives and drafting the alternatives in such a way that we had all of the components and elements there. This was a lot of work. And the way that you'll see that the document is constructed now, there are essentially four elements of the document. The first being the fishery management program and adjustments to the fishery management program, which include options for regulatory definitions, administrative and general provisions, measures to address carrier vessels and transfers at sea, trip notification requirements, dealer reporting requirements, and changes to open access permits for mackerel vessels. That all now falls under a section for the fishery management program. The next major component of the document is the catch monitoring at sea component, which includes alternatives to allocate observer coverage on limited access herring vessels, measures to maximize sampling by observers, measures to address net slippage, and an alternative for a maximized retention experimental fishery. The next section is measures to address river herring bycatch, and we have alternatives for monitoring and avoidance. We have alternatives for protection, and we have trigger-based approaches under both of those alternatives. And then the fourth and final element of the document is criteria to establish midwater trawl vessel access to the groundfish closed areas, which include options for increased observer coverage or measures to maximize sampling like the closed area one provisions, as well as an alternative to simply close the areas. So that's the general structure of the document. In your decision document, you'll see sort of a visual representation of that. Everything in your decision document should be color-coded. So all of your FMP adjustments are going to be blue. Catch monitoring at sea is, I think that's red. The colors are a little bit different here. Midwater trawl access to groundfish closed areas is actually purple, but I don't know, it's appearing orange here for some strange reason. Anyway, this is just sort of to give you an idea of how these alternatives all sort of fit together. So getting into the details of some of them, I'm not going to go through each of the list of alternatives because I think we spent a lot of time doing that in January, and at that time we knew which ones were complete and ready to go and which ones needed more work. One of the major elements that needed more work were the alternatives to allocate observer coverage. These were approved largely in concept by the council in January, so we spent some time fleshing them out and actually creating comprehensive alternatives. These are in your document. I've tried to put some references here to help you find your way, navigate your way through the document. Section 3.2.1, page 28. Each of the alternatives to allocate observer coverage includes four components. The first being whatever the targets or priorities are for allocating the coverage. The second being whatever the process is going to be for allocating the coverage. The third, how the coverage will be funded. And the fourth, if there is funding outside of federal funding, what the provisions are for service providers and authorizing waivers and things like that. And as a component of that fourth provision and that fourth element, there is also an option that would the council needs to consider to essentially grandfather states in as service providers. we can talk about that later, or we can talk about it when we make final decisions, but that is an option that's in the document. This table, which is hard to read on the presentation slide, but you have it in front of you. It's also in the document. This just summarizes the four alternatives that we have for allocating observer coverage on limited access vessels. Alternative one is no action, which means we would just follow the current process for allocating observer coverage. Alternative two is 100% observer coverage on A, B, and C vessels. Alternative three is that the SBRM coverage levels would be required as minimum coverage levels, which means that when the SBRM analysis takes place, the council would not have the liberty to shift days away from the herring fleets and reprioritize days to other fleets or anything like that. Whatever comes out of the SBRM would be minimum required levels for this fishery. And then, of course, any observer coverage on top of that would be additional. The fourth alternative is to allocate coverage based on the council targets. And if you recall, the council had identified a 30% CV for a 30% CV for haddock and Atlantic herring bycatch estimates, and a 20% CV for river herring catch estimates as targets. So that alternative, the fourth alternative there, is structured around meeting those targets. Because river herring is not currently a driving factor in the SBRM, because it's not a federally managed species, this alternative, because the target is a 20% CV on river herring, it sort of brings river herring in as a driving factor for allocating observer coverage. So it would require an analysis supplemental to the SBRM analysis. So there's two options. One option is that when the Science Center does their SBRM analysis, they would provide an additional analysis to show where additional days may be allocated to achieve a 20% CV for river herring on our herring fleet. The second option is that the PDT would do this and provide sort of a supplemental analysis to the council when the council makes its decisions about prioritizing observer days and allocating days throughout the fisheries. In terms of the river herring alternatives, they were approved by the council as sort of spatial management alternatives. And if you recall, when we developed these alternatives, the idea was to link the alternatives to specific management goals, one being monitoring, another being avoidance, another being protection. And each of those were associated with different areas, and the measures that would apply in those areas were different, depending on the goals. So that's kind of where we started. We ended up with three alternatives, one being a no-action alternative, the second being a monitoring/avoidance alternative, with various options for what to do in the monitoring and avoidance areas, and then the third being protection, which essentially would be closed areas. And the areas associated with alternative three are smaller and lesser because they would actually be closed areas. The monitoring and avoidance areas are larger areas. Anyway, you can take a look at that in the document. This just gives you an idea in terms of the areas that what we're talking about for monitoring and avoidance. Now, if you recall, these monitoring and avoidance areas are set up bimonthly. So we have areas for January and February, and then March and April, and then May and June. And the areas differ by every 2 months, and they're based on observer data and thresholds on where we've seen river herring encounters in the fishery. This map right here puts all of the blocks for the whole year on one map. And it just gives you an idea, like not all of these areas would be monitoring and avoidance areas in the same months, but it just gives you an idea of the extent of area that we're looking at for potentially increasing monitoring for river herring during certain times of the year. You'll also notice in the document and in the analysis that each of these blocks is labeled with a letter. We've gone through and labeled all of the blocks so that you can follow along in the analysis. There's discussion of each block in the analysis, and whether or not that block may, or, you know, how effective that block may be at achieving the goal that is set out for it. So the lettering is just to help you sort of keep things straight in the document. So if you're looking at, for example, well, here are the protection areas. This map shows you for the protection areas what we're talking about over the course of the year. But if you're looking at this block right here, I think that's S. I can't see very well. But if that's block S, then when you go into the analysis, you'll see a detailed discussion about block S. So this is just sort of a way to keep things linked and help you make your way through the analysis. In terms of the access to groundfish closed areas, again, this is section 3.4, and we have five alternatives under consideration that range from no action to completely closing the areas to midwater trawl vessels. These are the areas that we're talking about. I think you guys are relatively familiar with the year-round groundfish closed areas, so I won't spend too much time. They're the ones that are shaded solid on this map. Then the next section of the document, and it's a rather lengthy section, is the affected environment. Talia worked primarily on preparing this section of the document with a lot of help from other contributors, so I just want to recognize her work on this and thank her for that. The affected environment is broken down into five what we call valued ecosystem components. And those are the Atlantic herring resource, non-target species and other fisheries. That section includes all of your bycatch, as well as the other fisheries that we've identified for special consideration in the analysis, which are shad and river herring, mackerel, and groundfish. The third VEC is the physical environment and EFH. Fourth is protected resources, and then your fifth is fishery-related businesses and communities, which is your fishery, your herring fishery, and the communities that depend on the herring fishery. I'm not going to go through too much about the affected environment, because there's a lot in there, but I did just want to give you a couple of summary slides here. They are all labeled for the corresponding table or figure number in the document. So this is actually table 51 in the document. This gives you an idea of how many vessels we have in the herring fishery by permit category. A, B, and C are your limited access vessels. A and B are your limited access directed fishery. C is a limited access incidental fishery. And D is your open access. So in terms of the limited access directed fishery, based on 2010, we have about 46 vessels, 55 in the limited access incidental catch, and then over 2,200 have open access D permits. So your limited access herring fishery is about 100 boats, and those 100 boats are catching about 99.5% of all the herring that is landed. D vessels catch or land very little herring. Over 99% is caught by A, B, and C, and actually about 97% is caught by A. There are, I should mention again, you know, keep in mind there are only four B boats. And these are boats that only got a directed permit for areas 2 and 3. These four B boats do not qualify for the directed permit in all management areas. So these B boats, these four B boats, all have C permits to fish in Area 1. This is one fishery where you're allowed to have multiple permits because they're area specific. So here's another table you can't read. And actually, I can't read it either. So let me just turn to it here. This is a compilation of tables 63, 70, and 77 in the document. This just gives you an idea of what I was just describing, which is how much each of these permit categories contribute to the total herring landings. And as you can see, if you look at the if you look at the right-hand column here, 2010, in 2010, the Category A vessels landed 97% of the herring. We couldn't even include the Category B vessels because when you break it down by gear type and permit category and management area, with only four vessels, you run into confidentiality issues. But if you had combined the B vessels with the A vessels, you'd be up at about 98%. And then the sea vessels are just under 1%, and then the D vessels make up the remainder, which is not much. Oops. Okay, next is just a summary of recent landings in the fishery. And the first table here gives you a little time series of IVR catch by management area. You can see the impact of the 2010 specifications and the significant reduction in the ACLs that we experienced in 2010 that carry over through 2011 and 2012. Landings in 2009 were 102,000 metric tons, and they dropped to 67,000 metric tons in 2010. This is broken down for 2010 in this following table. Again, these are IVR totals. You'll notice that we are showing an overage in areas 1A and 1B. We are still waiting for the final tally of the 2010 catch from the National Marine Fisheries Service, because the final tally involves incorporating VTRs and other reports that kind of trickle in a little later, so that we pick up all of the landings that may have occurred in areas after the directed fishery closes and everybody's limited to 2,000 pounds. So I don't know at this point what the final 2010 catch numbers are. This is what we have in the based on the IVR reports. Once NIMS determines the final 2010 catches, if there are overages, we have accountability measures. Those accountability measures would kick in, and those reductions would occur for next year, for 2012, to make up for the overages. This gives you an idea from the herring landings in 2009 and 2010, where, and this is table 80 in your document, where the vessels are fishing and how much they're fishing in each of the management areas, and it breaks it down by gear type and permit category. You can see that almost all of the Area 3 fishery is Category A vessels, and then the rest of it is all broken down. B and C are grouped together here because, as I mentioned, those four B boats have C permits. And where you see the Cs here cannot report, this is because we had some confidentiality issues when you start breaking the data down into this level of detail. So that just gives you a very, very general look at the vessels that we're talking about in this fishery. The affected environment, if you go through it, it's over 200 pages. It breaks down all of this information by permit category, A, B, C, D, and gives you basically everything that we know about these vessels up through the 2010 fishing year. The discussion of impacts starts in section 5.0, page 320 of the document. And in general, there are several elements or sections of the impact analysis. What you'll see as you go through the impact sections, you'll see subsections for discussion of general impacts and the relationship of the measures to the goals and objectives. Any enforcement committee comments that may have been provided. The enforcement committee met in May of 2009 to review some of these alternatives when they were more conceptual. And they did provide some comments, and where those comments are still applicable, I've included them in the document. Then there's a section of general herring PDT comments, or sort of some qualitative assessment of the alternatives from the herring PDT. Then any technical or statistical analysis that is necessary or appropriate is provided in the document, and then there, following that, is a discussion of each of the measures or options and their impacts on the five valued ecosystem components. So, excuse me. I can't get my thing to work. Sorry. Okay, so going through some of the analysis, and again, I'm not going to go through each thing individually, but I just wanted to point out a few of the more interesting, I guess, elements of the analysis. This is Table 131. This is in the impacts of the changes to the open access permit provisions for the limited access mackerel vessels. We have measures that are proposing to increase the possession limit to either 10,000 pounds or 20,000 pounds for limited access mackerel vessels that did not qualify for a herring limited access permit. And we also discussed in the document potentially only applying this measure to certain mackerel permit holders. So we've broken it down here by the mackerel tiers, 1 and 2, I believe, being the limited access categories, and 3 being an open access. I'm not totally sure how the mackerel limited access program is constructed, but the tier 1 are your major players in the mackerel fishery, and as you can see, we have 2 of those vessels that have D permits and 3 that don't have any herring permits. So this just gives you a sense of how many boats, if you're going to increase the possession limit, how many boats you may be doing that for. You may want to consider ultimately only allowing Tier 1 and or Tier 2 boats to increase their possession limit. And the only reason that I say that is because there are some concerns from the PDT about opening this up to, as you can see here, over 300 vessels in the Tier 3 category, and potentially allowing for an increase in targeted fishing for herring in the southern New England area where we have some concerns about river herring bycatch. So if this measure is really intended to address the mackerel limited access vessels that did not get limited access herring permits, we've broken it down in such a way here that you can make your decisions based on how many vessels you want to accommodate through that measure. Moving on to some of the impacts of the alternatives to allocate observer coverage, and this is there's a lot of information in the document here. The table 134 here is just an example of, or 134 and 135 here are just some examples of the kind of analysis that you'll find in the document. We've looked at by gear type, and this is for the catch monitoring alternatives. The council made the decision that the catch monitoring alternatives are going to apply to the limited access herring vessels. Since that decision was made, we're looking at A, B, and C vessels here. And we have provided information about revenues per day and operating costs per day and per trip, as well as taking those numbers, applying the cost of Fisheries Observer Program Observer, and determining what percentage of the revenues that would equate to and how much that would increase operating costs for the vessels. Now, the observer coverage rate that we applied is the $1,200 a day that has been discussed in the past. And I believe that there was some information presented to the council yesterday about costs and differing costs. The PDT had made the determination since this council was, it was clear to us that the council wanted, if we're going to have additional observer coverage in this fishery and if it's going to come from a third party, the PDT is working under the assumption that the council wanted the data that's collected by a third party to be comparable or equivalent to the data that's collected by observers, or else why are we doing this? So because of the nature of this fishery and the sampling requirements in this fishery and the additional training that's required and the species identification issues and the subsampling protocols and the discard log and the slippage sampling protocols, we really felt there was no way to reduce the cost if a third party is involved. The training and the sampling that would be required to collect data that's comparable to what the observers are collecting necessitates essentially an NEFOP type observer to get that data, or else we're going to get data that we're not going to have the ability to compare to the observer data that the Science Center observers are collecting. So moving on, next table here, 136, gives you sort of a top-end estimate, and this is based on 100% observer coverage, which I think, you know, in the document, the PDT discusses this concept of diminishing returns and, you know, the fact that you get to a point in where you're investing a lot more into the coverage than maybe what you're getting out of it in terms of precision. But we went ahead and provided you sort of an upper bound of what it would cost for 100% observer coverage in this fishery. And as you can see for the A and B vessels, we're looking at about $2.3 million. Now, the C vessels we broke out a little bit differently here because there are a lot of days fished by C vessels that don't involve catching herring. So in this top table here, we only used the days for C vessels where herring was landed or caught. To give you an idea of the additional cost, but you can take a look down here at the total number of trips and days by sea permit holders. And in 2009, where you're looking at 96 days where herring was caught, you're looking at a total of 6,600 days fished by the sea vessels. So if you were actually to apply this measure to sea vessels, you know, all the time, you would be significantly increasing the cost. This just gives you a little bit of perspective on that. Now, in the document, what we've done with Alternative 4 is the one that the council wanted us to look at, how to achieve a 20% CV on river herring bycatch, how to allocate observer coverage in a way to achieve a 20% CV on river herring bycatch. Now, because of the variability and because of the way the SVRM works and everything else, this changes year to year. You always take last year's information and analyze last year in order to project ahead for next year to see what you need to do differently. So what we've provided in the document is an example of that analysis. And we took the 2010 data and we ran it through an analysis that would show you where you would need to put additional days in this fishery in order to achieve your 20% CV for river herring and your 30% CV for haddock and your 30% CV for Atlantic herring. This just gives you the totals across all of the areas. And if you look down here, this is a little bit confusing, but the stratification that's used in the SVRM is different than the stratification used by the PDT, and that's because of the way that river herring are distributed and the way that river herring is encountered in the fishery. Instead of looking at all of Georges Bank and Cape Cod collectively, we just looked at Statistical Area 521, the Cape Cod area, because we don't have a lot of river herring. We don't have any river herring encounters really out on Georges Bank. So what you see here sort of in the bottom table is that we've combined it. Based on the SVRM stratification, you're looking at 279 days here for the Cape Cod Georges Bank area. We went back and applied sort of proportions for how much of the fishery is occurring in each of those areas, and we determined that out of those 279 days, in order to get that 20% CV on river herring, you would need 45 days in that Cape Cod area. And then the other 234 days could occur anywhere around Area 3 in Georges Bank. Very complicated. I'm just giving you the bottom line right now. We can certainly go back and talk about this analysis in detail if you have any questions. These black squares right here are cells where we would be recommending pilot levels of coverage because we did not have enough trips in those areas to make any determinations. What's next? Okay, I just wanted to go over a little bit of the additional analysis that we've provided in the document about observer coverage and the measures to address net slippage and everything else. I did want to just, this is table 149 in the document. I did want to just give you sort of an overview of what observer coverage in this fishery has been like recently. This summarizes the coverage rates for 2009 and 2010. collectively. But we've had really good coverage in this fishery for the past couple of years, particularly in 2010. The PDT is confident in that the 2010 data are the best reflection of the fishery that we have and the best data that we have for the fishery. In 2009 and 2010, as you can see across these gear types and permit categories, we are looking at, you know, about a 40% coverage rate for Category A and B midwater trawl and paratrawl vessels. And again, that's 97% of your fishery, 98% of your fishery right there. And about close to about a 20% coverage rate on purse seine vessels. Where we are lacking is in the small mesh bottom trawl vessels. And that really is just more of a reflection, I think, of the diversity of the small mesh bottom trawl fleet. Some of them fish for herring, but a lot of them don't. For the most part, though, we have 30 to 40% coverage in this fishery for the last 2 years. Coverage last year in the Area 3 Georges Bank fishery was over 85%. Okay, so based on that information, we looked at the 2010 data to look at released catch and slippage, which has been a significant concern. Again, we're looking at almost 40% coverage in this fishery. We have a lot of confidence in this data and feel that it is the best reflection that we have of the fishery thus far. In 2010, the Observer Program also implemented a new discard log. They sent the observers through a retraining specifically for sampling high-volume fisheries in the herring fishery, and they implemented an observer discard log that provides detailed information on released catch in the fishery, which is essentially any catch that's not brought on board for various reasons. Released catch could be slipped catch. It could be operational discards. And also, this graph right here also includes discards that were brought on board. So this is all observed discards. And as you can see, these numbers up here at the top represent the total observed catch. These are not the discard numbers. So as you can see, let's just take this first one right here. In 2010, for bottom otter trawl, which did not have great coverage, in areas 2 and 3, 1.5 million pounds was observed, and of that 1.5 million pounds, about 2.6% of it was discarded. And it looks like all of it was brought on board and then discarded, which is consistent with how bottom trawls operate. If you look at the next one here, purse seine vessels fishing in Area 1A, 2.1 million pounds of catch was observed, and about 3.5% of it was observed to be discarded. The vast majority was not brought on board, which would be either a full or partial slippage. The blue here is operational discards, which are the small amounts of fish that remain in the net after pumping operation has finished. So the observers have been collecting a lot of information about released catch and catch that is not brought on board. In the document, you'll see a whole series of tables and figures that provide you more information, including reasons that were provided by either the observer or the vessel captain or the vessel operator on why the catch may not have been brought on board. There's also an extensive discussion in the document about the fish NK, not known, and herring NK categories, and when and why observers may document fish as either herring or fish NK. So hopefully you've had a chance to look at that. The observer folks are here if you have any specific questions. The next section of the document is an extensive discussion of the impacts of the management measures to address river herring bycatch. Again, I can't, we'd be here all day if I went through all of the details of it, but in general, the analysis has a lot of components to it, the first being an assessment of the coincidence or co-occurring overlap between river herring and shad. This is on page 407, and essentially what you'll see in the analysis is that these two species overlap such that any measures that we would implement to address river herring bycatch should similarly address shad bycatch or affect shad in a similar way. The next thing that you will see in the document on page 412 is a comparison of all river herring catch and removal estimates. We went through all of the available literature, the SBRM information, the observer data, the herring PDT analysis, and we put together a very extensive table on all of everything we know about estimates of river herring catch from every source. That's in the document for you to look at. On page 418, there's assessment of the monitoring and avoidance areas, which start with a discussion of the migration patterns of river herring and how those migration patterns may overlap in time and space with the monitoring and avoidance areas. Page 431 is the assessment of the protection areas. And then as part of that, we have got a somewhat complicated assessment of the impacts of spatial closures and triggers, catch triggers on the fishery. This includes a series of maps that show fishing effort, herring fishing effort, and how it is distributed relative to the proposed areas for monitoring and avoidance or protection, as well as some projections based on fishing patterns on when the river herring catch triggers may be reached if catch triggers are actually implemented in the fishery. And then starting on page 489 is the discussion of the impacts on the valued ecosystem components. This is an interesting table. This is table 139 in the I'm sorry, 159 in the document. And this is just, again, this is part of the assessment of the catch comparison analysis. This is 2010. Again, the herring PDT took the 2010 observer data, 30 to 40% coverage in our fishery, and we used that data to generate a total estimate of river herring removals from the limited access herring fishery. The total estimate of herring removals that we generated for 2010 is 165,915 pounds. That has a CV, I believe, of about 0.36. So we're not quite at the 0.2 CV yet, but we're getting way down there compared to where we were in the past. These numbers are highly variable, as you can see from the stars in this table. You know, the high values in previous years. I mean, these are variable numbers, but again, the PDT is relatively confident in the 2010 data. So we just wanted to show here in 2010, the PDT's estimate of removals from the limited access herring fleet is 165,915 pounds. That compares to the SBRM estimate of discards only from all fleets of 531,314 pounds, and that compares to the landings in the main state directed river herring fishery of 1.3 million pounds. The next element of the river herring impact assessment that you will see is a series of tables that look like the one on the screen here. And this is a qualitative assessment of the monitoring, avoidance, and protection areas. And what we've done here, if you look at the table, which you can probably see better on the piece of paper, you'll notice the letters across the top. Those are your blocks in the maps. Those go right across here. So for each of the blocks, we go down and address, you know, these questions to give you a sense of whether or not this area, how effective this area may be at achieving the objective of addressing river herring bycatch. And we looked at each area and asked the questions, for this area, are there adjacent fishery-based areas? Meaning, are there adjacent areas where we've seen the fishery encounter river herring? So that, you know, if you close the area and the fleet moves to the adjacent areas, are you going to have a probability of still encountering river herring? For the area, are there adjacent survey-based areas? If we haven't seen, regardless of whether we've seen a fishery interaction in the adjacent areas, has the survey picked up river herring in the adjacent areas? And then do the fishery-based areas overlap the survey-based areas? So this just gives you, again, some perspective on how effective the areas may be. I mean, one of the concerns that the PDT has about spatial management is if you close one quarter degree square and shift the fleet into the squares around it, which you can see by the patterns in the fishery, that's pretty much where the fleet's going to go because that's where the fish are. Are you going to actually address the problem that you're trying to address? And the only way that we can really tell you anything about that is to look at whether or not we've seen fishery encounters in those adjacent areas and whether or not the survey picks up river herring in those adjacent areas. I mean, there's really just no other way to quantify the potential impacts of these spatial measures. So, as a follow-on to that, here's what you've got for your mapping of the fishing effort. And it's a little bit hard to see here. Hopefully you can see it in the color copies. But we've got some gray hatched squares here, which are, this is for January, February, by the way. These are monitoring areas for January, February. The gray hatched areas are the areas that are proposed for monitoring in January and February. And then the colored blocks are where in the past 3 years, 4 years, I think in the past 3 years, yeah, the past 3 years, where the fleet and the fishing effort have been distributed relative to those monitoring areas. The red being higher than the greens. So your reds are your biggest areas where more of the fishing effort has been. The greens are where the rest of the fishing effort has been. And you can see where the overlap is with the monitoring areas. We've done that for each of the block month combinations for both monitoring and avoidance and protection. And then what you'll see is a series of tables that give you an idea of what percent of the fishing time for each of these block month combinations has been spent inside and outside of the monitoring areas, and how much of the herring catch from these vessels has come from inside and outside of the monitoring areas. This is tables 180 and 182. Without looking at the document, I'm going to assume that these are January, February monitoring areas. I'd have to go back and look. I'm hoping they correspond to the map I just showed you. And so you can see down below that, you know, for some of these monitoring areas, a significant amount of the herring catch from these vessels is coming out of these areas. So it's just going to give you some perspective on the potential impacts of either closing these areas or applying some sort of measures in these areas. And again, the impacts are going to be different depending on whether you require additional sampling in these areas, whether you require the industry to pay for observer coverage in these areas, or whether you close the areas. The industry may make very different decisions about where and when to go fishing based on what is going to go on in these areas. So the next component is to look at the triggers. If you recall, the PDT had come out and expressed some opposition to implementing catch caps right now for river herring in this fishery, but the council did determine that we should look at using some sort of trigger-based approach. So we have a whole series of options for triggers, and these fall under both the monitoring and avoidance alternatives and the protection alternatives. And the idea here is that the fishery would be sort of open without any additional measures or controls until these triggers are hit. And then once the triggers are hit, either the monitoring measures would apply or the protection measures would apply in these areas. So what we've done here is we've gone through and created these charts here, I don't even know what to call them, that show you the cumulative probability of hitting the triggers. This one is for the southern New England area. This is for the max. So this is your southern New England, 729,500 is your trigger. And it shows you that 54% of the time it's not triggered. This is based on, you know, doing this run 1,000 times. 54% of the time it's not triggered. The other 46% of the time it is triggered. About a 30% probability that it would be triggered by about April, maybe. And then it's about a 46% probability it gets triggered by the end of the year. So that just gives you a sense, and these, again, we go through each of the block month combinations to show, and each of the sub-options here for max, median, and mean to show you how likely or not the trigger is to be met. In some cases, it's very likely to be met. In other cases, it will probably never be met. So the next component of the river herring analysis is a series of tables that, again, very difficult to read, but hopefully you get a sense here. These are in the document, and hopefully you can read them in the document. I went through the document the other day, and I saw a couple of these didn't print very well, but we'll fix that. This just goes through and talks about, it's almost like pros and cons, but it's positive impacts, negative impacts from differing perspectives, a biological perspective, economic perspective, social impact perspective. It gives you just a qualitative sense of the trade-offs and the costs and benefits, if you will, of each of these potential options. And this sort of formed the basis of the discussion of the impacts on the valued ecosystem components. So, the one thing I did not put into this presentation is a discussion about, or a slide that summarizes the impacts of the midwater trawl vessel access to groundfish closed areas. That is analyzed in the document as well. I actually meant to put a slide in and just forgot. Hopefully you have had a chance to take a look at that analysis. For the most part, the PDT feels that decisions about midwater trawl vessel access to the groundfish closed areas are policy decisions that this council needs to make. We don't really, we've looked at the data and don't really see a technical basis for, recommending any specific measures for midwater trawl vessel access to groundfish closed areas. So we'll leave that entirely up to you guys to determine based on policy decision. So then we move into the decision document. I have a couple of slides here that are reflected in the decision document. The decision document is sort of a visual representation of all of these measures, as well as a summary of impacts. Hopefully you've had a chance to go through it. I think it's helpful in terms of taking and condensing all of this stuff into a few tables that give you sort of the bottom line. On page 27 of the decision document, you'll see the first decision that needs to be made, and that is some decision regarding the measures that are proposed for elimination in the document. And these appear in your document with strike through. They're stricken through or shaded or both. Proposed to be taken out of the document for various reasons. The first are the ACL and sub-ACL monitoring alternatives and the requirement for weekly VTR reporting. We had a whole series of alternatives in here to consider going from IVR to VMS reporting, to do daily VMS catch reporting, weekly VTR reporting. All of this was addressed through the NIMS rulemaking that just recently occurred. So we don't see a need to have these alternatives in the document anymore. The changes have already been made. So we need to consider taking those out. There's an option in the document that we're recommending to eliminate to fund the catch monitoring program from federally permitted dealers. Because there's no portside sampling element of this amendment, there's no portside element of the catch monitoring program, we really just could not figure out a way to construct a program where dealers would be paying for sea sampling on vessels. We just couldn't work it out. So we had some concerns about the feasibility of that, and there were some legal concerns about that as well. So we're recommending that that option be eliminated from the document. The other option that we're recommending to eliminate from the document is a measure that appears in the measures to enhance sampling, sea sampling, and that is an option to require flow scales on processing vessels. We don't have any processing vessels in the fishery at this time. Yes, there are still provisions that would allow that to occur. And if a processing vessel comes into the fishery, it would need to get an at-sea dealer permit, and it would be subject to all of the dealer reporting requirements and everything else. We just felt that at this point, there's so much in the document. We just really didn't feel that this was a necessary measure to have in the document at this time, and certainly didn't want to have to go through a full analysis of what the impacts of putting flow scales on processing vessels may be. So we're recommending eliminating that at this time. This is something that the advisors did reach consensus on, which is noteworthy in itself. But the advisors did support by consensus eliminating these measures from the document. Next, on page 28, you'll see the next decision, and I've actually broken this down into two decisions, 2A being action regarding some sub-options that are proposed to be added to the document. You'll see on page 26 in the reporting requirements for federally permitted dealers, we have added three potential sub-options for further consideration, and the council needs to make the decision as to whether or not these should go into the document. The original measure is to require the dealers accurately weigh all fish. In order to clarify that and perhaps help with administration and enforcement, we've suggested some sub-options. That would, 2A and 2B would require dealers to document either annually or by every purchase how weight is being estimated or how weight is being derived for a mixed catch. Particularly for bait dealers, if we're going to require them to accurately weigh all fish, the two sub-options in the document would require them to let nymphs know how they're going to do that, especially if they receive a mixed catch. The third option, 2C, requires a cross-check between dealers and vessels before the dealer report can be submitted, and this is, again, just to help sort of avoid data problems or inconsistencies between the databases. These measures were pulled directly from the Mid-Atlantic Council's mackerel amendment, and they're consistent with some of the measures that are being considered in Amendment 14. So we're suggesting them for inclusion in the document. The council needs to make the decision. The advisors did vote on this particular issue, just the dealer reporting options, and voted 5 yes, 4 no to support the inclusion of these options, certainly not unanimous. The second part of this we'll call 2B, and this is some decision regarding additional sub-options that are proposed for one of the measures to address net slippage. This appears on page 39 of your document. Option 4 to address net slippage is a option that would require a catch deduction of 100,000 pounds and possible trip termination after 10 slippage events. We had some trouble. There were some challenges with this option. It's we had some trouble with the way the original option was proposed, and I could get into those if we need to. But what we did is we worked to try to develop some additional options that still capture the intent of option four, but may be a little less troublesome from a legal perspective. Not to say that we don't still have concerns about the additional sub-options, but I was really just trying to make an effort here to take what the council had originally approved in January and make it workable. So we have sub-options 4B, C, and D in the document. 4B adds the closed area one sampling provisions to the catch deduction trip termination option. 4C does the same thing but does not include a catch deduction. And 4D does the same thing but drops the number of slippage events from 10 to 5 before trip termination would be required. So there's a whole range of options there that the council can discuss and consider, but we need some action taken as to whether or not those should move forward. The advisory panel could not reach consensus on this issue, and rather than vote, the individual advisors provided comments. Those are all reflected in the advisor's report. Okay, this is not in the decision document, but I did, as I was putting this presentation together yesterday, this came to my mind, and I figured I should also just include it in the presentation to let you know. In the measures to improve sampling, option 2F, pages 36 and 37, there's a slight change to the language that has been suggested by the Observer Program. I don't necessarily think that this requires council action, but I wanted you to be aware of it so that if you approve the document to move forward, you approve it with the understanding that we're going to probably be changing the language to reflect what the Observer folks have suggested. And this is regarding the measure that would require vessels to provide visual access to the cot end or the net after pumping has ended. The original language was a little bit wishy-washy and just said, you know, ideally on a trawl vessel, the cot end and any remaining contents would be brought on board after pumping. And then it goes on from there to say if this is not possible, then the vessel operator will work with the observer to ensure that the observer has visual access and the observer will document whatever he or she can see. That part stays the same. The only thing that changes is the sentences that you see on the screen here. The observer folks are just suggesting that instead of saying ideally the cot end would be brought on board, we just say on trawl vessels, the cot end and any remaining contents should be brought on board. And then that's followed with the sentence, if this is not possible, then so on and so forth. And you can see that language in the document. I just wanted to bring that to your attention. It's on page 37. So the next decision, we have 1, which is the stuff for elimination, 2A, which is the dealer reporting requirements for addition, 2B, the measures for slippage for addition. Third decision is approval of the draft EIS for formal submission and public hearings. The council needs to decide today whether this document can be approved and move forward for submission and public hearings. Recognizing that this document is not finished, it will be finished if it's approved today. The unfinished sections will be completed, the EFH analysis, the protected resources analysis, cumulative effects, all of the stuff that you say that still in here says to be completed. Any additional information and analysis that we can provide at the council's direction, we can do that. So if during the discussion the council determines that we should go back and look at something differently, provide additional information about something, if we get that direction from the council, we will do that in the formal submission document. And any further clarifications that the council wants to provide during the discussion today, if there's clarifications regarding the funding measures, anything, as long as we get that direction from the council, we will address that in the formal submission of the draft EIS, which, if we approve that today, would be sometime in early to mid-November. And then, assuming that the draft EIS can be approved by the council today, the fourth decision to be made is any selection of preferred alternatives for the purposes of public hearings. This is at the council's discretion. We don't have to go forward with preferred alternatives, but preferred alternatives can be selected for some sections of the document and not others. It's not an all or none. You could select preferred alternatives for all of them or none of them. There may be some elements of this document that we could reach agreement on today as to what the preferred alternatives are. It is helpful to go out to public hearing with preferred alternatives. It will help us to focus additional analysis in the formal document, as well as allowing the public to have a better understanding of where the council is leaning and what ultimately may be selected for final measures in the document. So that's about it in a nutshell. In terms of the timeline and what's next, if we can get this document approved at the meeting today, we, as I said, will be submitting the completed formal draft EIS in early to mid-November. It takes about 30 days, hopefully, most, for NIMS to approve the document and officially start the 45-day comment period. So we would anticipate that the comment period would start sometime in mid to late December and run through January. So we would do public hearings in January. And then rather than wait until April, we're not going to make the January council meeting. I think the timing with the comment period and stuff is going to make it impossible for us to select final measures at the January council meeting. But rather than wait to the April council meeting, we may want to consider having a special council meeting in February to select the final measures so that we can get the documents submitted by April. NIMS needs about 7 to 8 months to implement, a major regulatory change. So if we can submit it by April, we could get it hopefully implemented at the start of the 2013 fishing year, which I think would be really ideal at this point because we have a stock assessment in June of next year, and we will be doing specifications right after that. So it would be really nice to have this amendment implemented with a new specs package starting on January 1, 2013. So that's the timeline we're shooting for if we can get the document approved today and move forward to public hearings this winter. That's all I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions for clarification on my presentation or anything about the specific details of the analysis. I have a lot of my PDT members here, hopefully. I haven't turned around to see, but I'm sure they're all sitting behind me somewhere. And we can try to answer any real specific technical questions for you. Thank you.
That's all? A great, great piece of work, Laurie. The presentation is terrific. I think it lays out the issues that are before us with this. My congratulations to you and to Talia for all the work that's been put into it. I think before we get down into the weeds on this issue, we'll take a 10-minute break and then come back and tackle it. But thank you. Council members, do you have any questions for Lori on her presentation? Dave Gaethel.
Morning, Lori. I have some questions, and it may just be me, but I'm having trouble understanding some of the tables. I'm going to start with table 26 on page 143. And it's just a representative of a number of tables that are here. It says catch and discards of all species on observed trips, bottom trawl category D. Are these herring trips or is this groundfish trips or, I mean,
excuse me, I This is information that we've carried over and updated from multiple documents, and I was almost a little bit reluctant to put these tables in the document. But it, what it is it's I believe it is Category D boats on any trips with 2,000 pounds or more of Atlantic herring. So it's not all Category D trips that were observed. It's the observed trips on 2,000 pounds, trips where 2,000 pounds or more of Atlantic herring was landed or observed.
Okay. I mean, because it has, I mean, as an example, I mean, we're not allowed to keep groundfish. And it has, you know, pounds capped cod, 604,000.
These wouldn't be, quote-unquote, herring trips or directed herring trips. These are just trips where 2,000 pounds or more of herring was observed. So you could have been ground fishing or whiting fishing or something and encountered some herring, and that would be in here.
Okay, well, I think I'd make a suggestion on all those tables if they could be just limited to small mesh trips or something. To get the, I mean, for example, if you're a gill netter and you're on a groundfish trip, you get a lot of herring in the net, you can conceivably get 2,000 pounds of herring out of big mesh, but it's not a directed herring trip. I just think those tables should be revised to show trips where it's a herring trip, it's a directed herring trip, because otherwise I think it's kind of misleading. So that was one, and that's. For there's a whole series of those tables in here, not just B-boats. I just picked one out. The second question I had is, in section 3.4 with the closed areas, if we change the closed areas, does this section gets put in, does it change automatically to the new closed areas, or does it still stay with the closed areas as they exist at the time of the document?
Okay, going back to your first question, Talia just confirmed for me that that's all trips, not just ones with 2,000 pounds or more. And I agree with your comment. That's why I said I was a little bit reluctant to even put those tables in the document because I was afraid they'd be misconstrued and taken out of context. So I'm going to flag that section, and we're going to go back and rework that section for the formal document. Regarding the year-round groundfish closed areas, if this action precedes any action to change or eliminate or do whatever to the year-round groundfish closed areas, then this action will apply in the current year-round groundfish closed areas. If any changes are made to these closed areas, there would have to be a concurrent change to the herring regulations. So if there's going to be an action to eliminate these groundfish closed areas, for example, which I've heard, but I don't really know what the status of that is, that action would have to contemplate whether or not those areas should remain herring management areas or herring monitoring areas or something like that. So whatever action is taken to change the groundfish closed areas is most likely going to have to address herring midwater trawl vessel access and regulations in either the new areas or in the previously closed areas. And we may end up having to do like a joint framework with the herring plan or something like that to deal with that. It's all going to be a matter of timing. We're moving forward right now with the current existing year-round closed areas. And, you know, if those change before we get this amendment done, then we'll have to make the changes accordingly. But if they go away, if there's an action taken to get rid of the year-round groundfish closed areas, then the council would have to consider whether or not to maintain those areas as some form of a herring midwater trawl monitoring area or something like that.
Okay. Another question on table 135 in your presentation. It has revenues and costs, but I don't quite understand what the cost part is. Does it mean the costs go up by 100? Like it says bottom trawl, revenue 22.5%, costs 152.8%. Does that mean costs go up by 152%?
Yes, I'm trying to just find the table in the document, but yeah, essentially the way that you would read that is if the observer coverage were funded by the industry, bottom trawl per day operating costs would be 152.8% of what they currently are. So they would go up by half. You know, they would increase by that much. So based on the estimates in the previous table of the operating costs per day, you would, you know, it would be 152% of that if you had to pay for an observer on that trip.
Okay, I thought that's what it was. I just wanted to be sure I understood it right. And the last comment I had or question was, I understand for confidentiality reasons you had to lump the B boats apparently in with somebody, but I would suggest lumping them in with the A boats instead of the C boats because I think it dilutes the effects of these measures on the C boats substantially. I mean, the B boats are still large vessels fishing offshore. The C boats are predominantly people in other fisheries that have been sucked into this morass. So I would, if you have to combine them with somebody for confidentiality, I do A, B, and then let C stand alone and let D stand alone. That's just a suggestion. I think it would help to show what the true costs of some of these measures are for the smaller boats.
Anyone else? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Larry, I echo the praises that has been given you and staff so far regarding the way in which this information has been provided to us. Thank you very much. I've got a question and a request. In the report of the plan development team, June 29th, as well as in the one dated August 10th, and these are both final plan development team reports, I guess everything is final. Kind of humorous. You note, and you did so in your presentation, that the 2010 observer coverage rates on limited access vessels was relatively high. You described the consequences of that, consequences that relate to the decisions we have to make here today about options that relate to slippage events, operational discards, and the like, river herring, of course, being one species we're concerned about. It would be helpful to me if, and I'm sure other council members, if when we go through this decision document, if you could highlight how this 2010 observer coverage and the way the observer program is now doing business, you know, better forms, different way of assessing discards and slippage, if you could help us understand how 2010 might influence our decision-making on those options that pertain to discard, slippage, and the like. I say that because I've been involved in this, in the development of this plan now, it seems like 5 years, but it can't be that long, 3 years, many, many meetings with a focus on observer information, the way the observer program does its business, and I've made some decisions over the years that were related to the way the program was run during those years. Now it seems we're in a different world, so to speak. Circumstances have changed, and I would like to know, using your judgment, your views, as to how those circumstances have changed to the extent that they might impact the decisions that we make on these options. Okay, so just please keep that in mind. You may do that anyways, but I would want that to be highlighted as we move through the decision document. And then finally, on page 4 of that plan development team document that summarizes the June meeting, the end of June meeting, there's a statement regarding plan development team recommendation. And it's relatively short. The plan development team recommended that the analyses include the SBRM importance filters to illustrate which strata contribute little to discards or mortality but may require high levels of observer coverage due to the variability resulting from the catch estimates. Now, My question is, because that recommendation was made back at the end of June and a few months have gone by, does the plan itself, the draft plan itself, does the decision document has that work been completed with the plan development team's recommendation having already been acted on, so that indeed an analysis was done to include those SBRM importance filters? Has that been done so we don't have to worry about that being work to be done? It's all set.
Yes, and that is reflected in the analysis of alternative 4, which is the alternative that targets the council priorities, the 20% CV on river herring and the 30% on haddock and herring. That is, I'm trying to find it in the document so that you can look at it. Good Lord. Here we go. It is starting on page 359 of the document, and it describes the data and methods that were used, and we did, in fact, use a very similar type approach to the SBRM, except, of course, you know, the main difference being that the SBRM looks at discard to kept ratio, and we looked at total removals because much of the bycatch in this fishery is not discarded, it's actually landed. So we looked at total removals of the species to total catch as the ratio, and we did apply the SBRM filters. And the other thing that we did that you'll see in the document is that we looked at, even though we used a different stratification, we looked at cells that would require some level of pilot coverage, which is another thing that the SBRM approach utilizes. That all is on starts on page 359 of the document. And this is that whole exercise, and the analysis that you're referring to is just an example of, if we take this approach, this would be the type of stuff that we would have to do on a year-to-year basis to take last year's observer coverage and last year's data, see where we ended up, see what the CVs were, and then do the projections forward using the SBRM type analysis to see where we would need to distribute the observer coverage in the following year to improve those CVs.
Any other comment? Doug?
Yeah, just one other comment for Lori on the analysis, and I think Dave alluded to it a little bit. We made a motion at the January meeting that we wanted the analysis to reflect an analysis on the directed fishery, the A and B, and then an analysis on the C permits, which are the limited access non-targeted fishery, and then the open access D permits. And I think the PDT did a very good job on many of the sections in there in conducting that analysis. The one section that I noticed that there was we could have extra work done a little bit in separating things out was in the river herring section there under Section 5, the impacts under Section 5. So I'd like to see that broken out by A, B, and then C, and then D.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, given that Maine has a significant interest in the herring resource and fishery, I've been thinking about this amendment for quite a while. And I have a number of comments, but I guess the first question I have is a process question to you and to Lori and to Doug. And it's, is it the intention here to go through the document item by item, or the intention to move the entire document ahead and only address the four motions in the decision document? And that's going to kind of steer which way I go.
Doug.
Thank you. Terry, at the end of the decision document that's provided to the council here, there are the last three or four pages is what the decision document. After we threw with questions here and I provide the advisory panel report, the intent here was not to go through the entire document item by item because many of these items the council has already approved for inclusion. What we have for decisions here are, one, there are a number of measures that the PDT, as they were developing this document, felt for one reason or the other could potentially be removed. And you'll see that under action, under the number one action measures to propose to eliminate. There's three there. And I intend to, since we haven't had a committee meeting and it was my decision as this that this document was going to be completed so close to the council meeting that we weren't going to have time to have an AP meeting, have a committee meeting, and then within a couple days later have a full council meeting. So it was my decision as committee chair to address these specific measures as a committee of the whole here. Then, as we go, the other thing that we need to address is that there are some suggested measures that the PDT had for potential inclusion in the document. They're measures that the council and the committee have not seen yet, and they include some potential changes for dealers and how they are going to be reporting the catch, and then some potential changes as they reflect the slippage events. After we get through some decisions on that, then we get to item three here, and it's a sort of an opportunity. Are there any additional information or analysis that the council wants to request? Is there any further clarification that anybody on the council wants to have included in the document? And if there isn't, or if there is, we'll debate that. But then we'd approve the draft EIS we'd consider approval of the draft EIS for submission in public hearings. And that would be a third motion that we have. Finally, after we've done that, I'm going to ask the body politic here, would you like to select some preferred alternatives on either some or all of the sections here? I'll open it up for any kind of motions at all. If people don't want to have preferred alternatives, that's fine, but if there are some, it certainly helps focus some of the comments when we have preferred alternatives, some of the public comments. So that's my intention here, Terry, on the process for the rest of the day.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. I know Lori and Talia and PDT have been working extremely hard, and I'm somewhat handicapped by only receiving decision document this morning. I didn't understand the process. I am not interested in going methodically through this document. It's my intention to move it forward as a whole today. So if we can make some minor tweaks, that's good with me. But four motions will be probably plenty.
Any further questions, comments? Tom.
Lori, on page 32 of the draft EIS, it discusses utilizing observer service providers. And you mentioned the NEFOP program and utilizing their expertise. And yesterday we heard an awful lot about minimizing costs through the use of third-party providers with oversight. Should it be my understanding, I guess, is the question, that this being included in the document, we're not binding our hands to use exclusively NEFOP coverage and that we would actually be able to use ATSI monitors and third-party providers to reduce costs?
Well, yes and no. If you turn to, okay, let me just think for a second of where this is in the document. Essentially, what this comes down to is if the council determines that some level of observer coverage is going to be paid for by the industry, if the funding option is selected that the industry is going to pay for some component of observer coverage, then we need to come up with, some specific standards and requirements for service providers. What we've proposed and what we've moved forward with in this document is that the service providers would have to meet the standards that are already laid out in the regulations for all the service providers for other fisheries, scallops, groundfish, whatever. But in terms of the actual program and the sampling, there's a huge difference between what we're calling them is NIMS-approved observers. So they don't necessarily have to be NEFOP observers, but they have to be observers that meet the standards and requirements and have been approved by NIMS. We have moved forward with the analysis I'm trying to find it in the document as I'm talking to you, and it's not working out very well. I'll try to find it in a second. But we've moved forward in the document with the assumption that that we're talking about a NIMS-approved observer that would be collecting information on a level that is comparable to the NEFOP observers. That is not what ATSI monitors do. ATSI monitors have a much more limited much more limited requirements for sampling. They're on the boat for specific purposes, and the data that they're collecting is not data that just gets added to the observer program data. It's different data. It's different sampling. Our understanding was that because the goal of this amendment is to generate catch estimates that have a relatively high level of precision and accuracy and can be reflective of, catch and bycatch throughout the fishery, that we wanted, that the council wanted any additional coverage provided by service providers to be at the same level of detail as the NEFOP observers. Now, with this particular fishery, you're not talking about just putting an observer on the boat to count fish. This is a high-volume fishery. The protocols for sampling the fishery are different than other fisheries. It's not like the groundfish fishery. NEFOP specifically trains their observers to subsample and do extrapolations for this fishery. There's timing issues. There's species identification issues with river herring and herring. And there's the discard log, slippage, pictures that are taken with slippage events, all kinds of things that go well above and beyond what you would consider for an ATSI monitor, at least the way it's constructed in groundfish. And somewhere in this document is a statement to the effect that if, we do go with some form of an industry-funded observer program, the council would have to clarify, that if we have additional observers coming from somewhere else, that these are the things that we want the observers to collect, and this is the kind of information. Okay, thank you. I'm way off. Page 351. There we go. Wow, all right. I'm like 300 pages off. Sorry, I was in a totally different section of the document. Yes, on page 351, 52, 53. At the bottom of page 351 is a paragraph, essentially, that says, you know, if we go down this road, and this can be done during sort of the final stages, but, you know, this isn't something we need to hold up the document for, but if we are going to require, if we do determine that the industry is going to pay for some amount of coverage, we need to set the standards for what the observers, the additional observers are going to collect. The at-sea monitoring program from Groundfish, my understanding is that all kind of came about after the fact. It was determined that there was going to be this, you know, at-sea monitoring program, but the details and the standards and things like that were sort of developed after that decision was made. And what you end up getting from that program is different than what you get from a NEFOP observer. So, you know, it's hard to answer that question without knowing specifically what we're going to be doing about industry funding and what the council wants out of industry-funded observers. But we've moved forward in this document because of the goals and objectives of the catch monitoring program. We've moved forward with the assumption that the council wants data that is comparable and additive to the observer data. So having said that, we've used the cost estimate that is comparable to the NEFOP observers.
Right, so just distilling that down, so recognizing that this is like the SEAL Team 6 of observers, that these are the best of the best, and for all the reasons that you stated, they have to be. The takeaway is they can be private, so we can go with we set the standards, of course, but they can be non-government observers.
Yes. I don't know how much cost you're going to save by doing that, but yes.
Any other questions? Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The FMAT for Amendment 14 to the Mackerel Plan met recently last week. And their report just came out, and I wanted to share several of their findings with you all today that I think are relevant. And, you know, I think in an ideal world, we've discussed before that as we manage herring and mackerel, ideally we would have coordinated and at least compatible measures to address these issues. We've been working for the last year on a relatively fast parallel track to develop Amendment 14 to address the monitoring requirements in the mackerel fishery, to try to better understand river herring interactions, and also to develop management measures that would conserve river herring. And many of these objectives are obviously identical to what you're trying to do here in Amendment 5. And so we sought to build on that experience. And as we got into this, we had a number of options in our document that were similar to Amendment 5. But just last week, again, the FMAT met, and several of their findings, I think, are significant. One is that they recommended that we bring back the dockside monitoring option, which had been previously eliminated from the document. Second, they're recommending a fleet area type cap. In other words, a cap that would be for river herring or river herring and shad bycatch. For midwater trawls in New England or midwater trawls in the mid-Atlantic, recognizing the fact that this fleet of midwater boats is essentially the same fleet that's operating on herring and mackerel. And so it becomes difficult to try to identify a trip as a herring trip or a mackerel trip, but it would rather make sense to manage by gear type and by large-scale area. Third, they recommended that we delete the small-scale time and area management options from the document, that is the Amendment 5, the options that are in Amendment 5 that are oriented on a relatively small-scale time and area basis. They concluded that that it would be problematic to close a small area given the degree of uncertainty about potential bycatch associated with displaced effort to other areas, and so they thought the conservation benefits were questionable on a small-scale basis and recommended that if we were to consider time and area management, it be done on a very large-scale basis. And obviously, if we did that, it might preclude the fishery altogether. So they are recommending, it appears at least in terms of the conceptual approach, more of a gear and area cap for river herring and shad bycatch. That's a significant departure, I think, from perhaps the direction of Amendment 5, and so I raise it as a concern. Again, I think ideally we would have a good degree of coordination between the plans, but I raise the issue relative to the timeline as well. You know, perhaps we can have some sort of step down the road where we come back. We're going to meet in 2 weeks as a council, and the committee will meet on the first day of that meeting and develop the options for the document. And so as we go out with our options, perhaps we could have some opportunity between now and the time when you would finalize your selection of options in your document to review the issues as they've been developed at that point in time, and at least try to have you know, some sort of reasoning as to how we can come out of the end of the process with a coordinated approach to the issue. And again, we sought to build on the work that you had already done in Amendment 5. These are recent developments at the FMAT level. They haven't been reviewed by the committee or the council, but I just wanted to bring them to your attention and also raise the prospect of somehow reviewing this question at a joint level or back here after we've done some work at the committee and council level to try to ensure that we have a coordinated approach to the question, because we're basically managing the same fleet, whether they're operating on herring or operating on mackerel. Those midwater trawl boats, at least, are essentially the same boats. So, you know, I think we need to make sure that we have an opportunity to have a coordinated approach to the question. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think from our side, I don't think there will be any, you know, concerted pushback on the effort to try and coordinate where we can. But I think, you, as you pointed out, there may be some real timing issues on all of this. Thank you. Anyone else? Pat and then Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question on the requiring the dealers to weigh the fish. The description of the management measures is very brief and I think is fine. When you read through to the impact section, there's still one of the examples is volumetric measurement. And I just want to clarify that's the council's intent to continue to include that. It wasn't exactly how I remembered where we ended up. So I think we just need to clarify it.
Laurie, do you have a response to that question?
Well, not really. I mean, it wasn't really clear, and that was one of the things that we definitely looked into. So it's a, you know, it's in the analysis still.
Mary Beth.
I don't think I'll comment on that. It's a little difficult to know where to begin with the document because there's a lot of places that aren't fully analyzed, and I think I'm not going to particularly go there at the moment. But I did have just a couple questions on the observer coverage section, Laurie, and alternative 2 begins on page 29. And when I read through alternative 2, I really didn't understand exactly what it meant. So I read it like 2 or 3 times, and I was still confused. And then I found when I read through all of the alternatives in this section, I think it was a little bit more clear. But because on alternative 2, which is 100% coverage, and then there's a description on page 30 of the provisions for utilizing observer service providers and authorizing waivers, if you have a requirement for 100% coverage, you don't utilize waivers at all, right? It just, the way it was structured, I think, was difficult. And so I'm thinking if it was difficult for me to understand, that if we take it out to the public, that there'll be confusion there as well. Do you understand what my question is on that?
I do, and I mean, this is something that I talked with the regional office staff about, and I mean, the provisions for utilizing service providers and authorizing waivers should be pretty consistent with what's already in the regulations. Not to say that waivers are going to be granted under any circumstance, but there may be some crazy event that prevents a vessel from being able to get an observer on the boat, whether it's through a service provider or through a NIMS observer. So there are provisions currently in the regulations that allow NIMS under circumstances where the vessel has contacted, you know, the science, you know, the NEFOP folks and been told to go contact a service provider, and the vessel has contacted all of the service providers and there's no observer available for whatever reason. So it's really sort of a fallback to allow NIMS to issue a waiver, to allow them, to allow the vessel to go fishing. And there's also an opportunity here, you can see on page 31, where the council may decide that there are certain instances where waivers should not be authorized. For example, in, you know, an area that you require, if you require 100% observer coverage, for example, in the river herring monitoring areas, you may never want to issue an observer, a waiver in those areas. You may want to say that in the, you know, river herring monitoring areas where 100% observer coverage is required, if you can't get an observer, you can't go in those areas. So there's just some flexibility there for the council to say, you know, waivers can't, should not be issued in circumstances X, Y, and Z, but there's also the fallback provision here for NIMS if there's some unusual event to allow them to issue a waiver so that a boat does not have to miss a fishing trip if it has made every effort to get an observer that it could possibly make.
Well, thank you, because that's helpful. But I'm not for the public to read that section. I think it's likely that they're going to be as confused as I had been, so you might want to just think about that. And then on page 32, at the top of the page, it refers to the SBRM fleets to which this alternative applies. And it's alternative 3, and it lists New England Midwater Trawl, Mid-Atlantic Midwater Trawl, and New England Purse Seine. And is there a specific reason why it would not be inclusive of bottom trawl herring vessels? Because certainly you showed tables in which the percentage of their contribution to total herring catch is quite small. But we also know that in certain areas and times of the year, their contribution to river herring incidental catch can be quite significant. So if, does this mean if we were to choose this option that we would be excluding them from this alternative?
Yes, we did not include the New England and Mid-Atlantic bottom trawl fleets because just the this is a really complicated issue. This is one that I've really struggled with, actually. It's the analysis is on page 349 and 350. Of the document, and it really only looks at the midwater trawl and purse seine fleets, and it's primarily because of the diversity of the small mesh bottom trawl fleets. These are measures, the catch monitoring alternatives and the allocation of observer coverage, these alternatives are intended to only apply to A, B, and C vessels. The council made that decision that the catch monitoring alternatives would only apply to A, B, and C vessels. And there's not a, there aren't a ton of A, B, and C vessels that are primarily small mesh bottom trawl. There are some. So we just couldn't, it was too, the SBRM small mesh bottom trawl fleets for New England and Mid-Atlantic include so many other vessels that are not A, B, and C herring permitted vessels that we just could not justify bringing them into these requirements. It would extend these requirements and the allocation of observers way beyond the category A, B, and C vessels. So in terms of just trying to focus on the limited access herring fleet, we had to limit it to these three SBRM fleets.
Well, we do know that we have, you know, bottom trawl vessels in category A, B, well, I don't know about B, actually, but certainly in A and C. And we also know that in certain areas at certain times of the year, the river herring bycatch from those vessels can be significant. So if our goal is to fully capture river herring bycatch in the herring fishery, and we choose this alternative, it seems to be rather flawed if we can't bring in those vessels. So is there a way to adjust this alternative so it would be a viable alternative if that was your goal, or just not? I mean,
well, like I said, this is something that I've struggled with, and it's really the problem is that the SBRM fleets and the way that the SBRM is stratified by fleet, vessel, category, and things like that, it's not done based on FMPs and permit categories, and it's just there's no way to directly link vessels that we're managing, just the vessels that we're managing in this fishery, to the SBRM process. It's just impossible. There's a lot of overlap, and we've identified the three SBRM fleets where the majority of the overlap occurs, but it doesn't include everyone. And bringing in the other SBRM fleets is going to include so many more vessels that we felt that that sort of defeated the purpose of trying to focus in on the limited access herring fleet. So, you know, any alternatives that utilize some element of the SBRM, which, you know, I'm not clear where we are with the whole SBRM right now, but any element, assuming I'm still working under the assumption that the SBRM exists and that we're, we base this analysis on the current SBRM methodology. There's no direct connection because the SBRM is not stratified based on fishery management plan. So we basically had to do the best we could. And any alternative that utilizes some element or relates to the SBRM in some way isn't going to provide you a direct connection. It's just, unfortunately, it's the way that the two processes have been constructed. And the SBRM, because it has to address so many different fisheries throughout the region, it's not FMP-based. So we've tried to provide as much linkage to the limited access herring vessels as we can.
You got more on this?
Just one more comment or question on this section. So that makes that alternative questionable if it's really going to address our goals for river herring. But as a more general question, in other parts of the document we have references to, let's say, groundfish closed areas which may have 100% observer coverage, and we also have alternatives that would allow for less than 100% observer coverage. In this section, we have the three different methods, and I'm just wondering, is the analysis sufficient so that the council, when we come to decision-making, can choose something much more simple than these alternatives? And we could just conclude, well, we have these concerns, and we think 30% coverage across the fleet is sufficient. Is the analysis here so that we have that flexibility?
I think you could probably argue that since we have 100% in status quo in the document, so we've got, everything in between. We would have to redo the analysis to really look at, the specifics of whatever is ultimately selected, but 100% certainly bounds the range. I feel like we tried to do that at one point. I remember trying to advocate for a simpler approach that just looked at percentage-based coverage for the limited access fleet. I can't remember the reasons why we didn't do that. But I know we talked about it, and we still ultimately ended up adopting this kind of approach. I think the 100% was left in there by the council to give you a little bit of flexibility in final decision-making. Again, recognizing, though, that, we're not going to be able to really fully evaluate all the impacts until we know specifically what we're talking about, and that makes it hard for people to really understand what the impacts are going to be.
Doug, what I would like to do is to now focus the council's discussion on the motions that will get us to where we need to be with this decision document. So I'm going to turn to you to put those out. Just in terms of process, before I do, I just want people in the audience to understand the process that I've been using for the last couple of days is that once a motion is put on the floor and seconded, I will then go to the audience for comments on that motion. Then it comes back to the council for their debate and decision on that motion. So I turn it over to you, Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One just question concerning the revisory report. Would you feel that we should just let the council read the advisory report as opposed to give a verbal oral report? Is that your preference in moving on to the decision-making process?
Well, I mean, I think the issues that we have before us that have been had some decision work done by the AP, I think Lori did a very good job of laying out what their decisions on these are. So I would kind of think that, no, let's get on with it.
Okay, thank you very much. I ask you to, the council to turn to page 27 of the decision document. There are a series of measures here that are proposed for elimination. And since we have not had a committee meeting, I'm going to make motions related to this, and hopefully I'll get a second on this. And then we can have discussion on the motion at this point. There are three areas that the PDT is recommending that we eliminate from the document. As mentioned in the presentation, one reflects some of the ACL, sub-ACL monitoring and weekly BTR reporting. This has already been addressed in NIMS rulemaking. There's also an item B that they're recommending, and that is the funding for catch monitoring, i.e. observer coverage, by federally permitted dealers. They were recommending that that be eliminated. And item C in the decision, in this particular decision, is option 2G, to require flow scales on processor vessels. So I am going to make a motion to remove the ACL, sub-ACL monitoring alternatives from section 3.1.5, the weekly VTR reporting from section 3.1.2, the funding catch monitoring program from federally permitted dealers from section 3.2.1, and the requirement for flow scales on processor vessels from section 3.2.2.2. And if I can get a second to that, okay, I'd like to speak to it just briefly.
Is there a second? Dave Gaethel?
Just as mentioned here, when the AP addressed this, there was a unanimous, it was a consensus to eliminate all three of these measures.
Thank you. I will go to the audience to see if there are any comments on this motion. Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the council. Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a motion to amend and that would be to delete the 3.2.1 option for funding catch monitoring program from this above amendment. My rationale is that there's been expressed interest from a number of industry, including this in the range of alternatives.
This one.
Is there a second to that? Rodney, discussion. Sally?
Well, I missed the rationale.
Thank you, Sally. I've heard an opinion expressed from a number of industry members that they would like to have this alternative retained in the document.
Dave Gaisel.
I'm just having a hard time finding all these things in the document. You get a page number, Terry? Which thing you're talking about?
I think it's
on the decision document. It refers to page 28.
It's under the observer alternatives. It appears on page 30 under alternative 2 as strikeout fund catch monitoring from federally permitted dealers. And I guess I would just, if this motion passes, it would be helpful to get a little clarification from the council members on how such a funding program may be constructed. I mean, we kind of went back and forth about this a lot and didn't come up with anything. So if you wanted to move forward in the document, I think we're going to have to do more than just say we're going to have dealers fund it.
Terry.
Laurie, that would be the intent of taking it to public comment. There are a number of measures in this document that I don't have clear answers on how we're going to move forward with. And if this does rise or fall, it's going to be upon the quality of comment that comes out during the public comment period.
Any further discussion? Dave Gaisel.
I understand Terry's concern. My question is, what would be the authority under – this would basically be a dealer tax of some kind. And what would be the authority to tax a dealer, and who would collect the tax? I guess my question is, does this council have the ability to tax people? I don't think we do. That's why I'm asking.
I guess my answer to you, David, would be if we don't know the answer to that, we can withdraw it from the document with a number of the other issues that we're probably going to be streamlining as after public comment period.
That's fine. I think we just need to raise some of these issues on the record right now so that somebody can start looking into them, so that when we have public comment, they can comment one way or the other.
Karen, as Rodney was the seconder on that. Jim.
Question of the maker of the motion. I just want to be clear. By moving the weekly VTR section reporting, what does that leave us with? How do they have to report?
It would be retaining it, not removing it.
It would be retained?
Retaining it.
Weekly VTR reporting would be retained?
No, we would be retaining the option for a funding catch monitoring program as part of one of the reporting options. It's an option to be retained in the document.
Laura.
I think the proposal to eliminate it was because it was already handled through a different action. That's why they were taking it out of the document.
Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Two things. First, I think there's some confusion, at least on my part, as to what the original Terry's motion is doing. The original one was to eliminate all three of these options. As I understand it, Terry's is no, only to eliminate A and C and retain V. So I'm correct on that. Okay. On option B, there is a feasibility and legal concerns issue, and that's my question. If there's, in following up on Dave Gaethel, if there's no way to do this, then it should come out. So I'd like to hear what the legal concerns are and what are their vices on that.
I think that General Counsel is going to help us reflect upon that momentarily.
Well, as I understand it, if it has to do with an option requiring the collection of fees or taxes or whatever by the agency to fund this, then that's, unless it's specifically provided for in the Madison-Stevens Act, we can't do that. And we are limited under Madison-Stevens Act to collecting the fees to reimburse for permitting of vessels. And unless we're unless it's a limited access privilege program or IFQ, we have no authority to collect fees beyond administrative costs for issuing permits. And because this is not a limited access privilege program at this time, we don't have the authority to collect for other costs such as monitoring.
Can I ask you just a process question then, that if it appears that this is something that can't be done because of that, essentially, is that motion out of order?
Well, I don't know if it's out of order. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, I mean, I guess the document could discuss that this option was raised, but it was, I mean, I think it's appropriate for the council to take the legal advice and realize that it's not something that can be legally endorsed or allowed to happen. And the public document could reflect that. I think it would be improper to put this in the public document for comment with the implication that it could be passed and implemented.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Given Gene's advice, I'm going to withdraw the motion and with the one comment that this is an option on a number of the other funding mechanisms. And, Laurie, have you reflected that through the rest of the document? I'm withdrawing the motion, but noting that this is an option for funding on a number of the other alternatives. And so it's PDT's recommendation that this funding mechanism be eliminated for all the other alternatives. Okay.
Okay, since we have been debating that without objection, the withdrawal of that amendment. Seeing none, that amendment is withdrawn. We're back on the main motion. Any further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion so indicate. Seventeen. Doug, you're starting off on a Dave Gaethel role. It must be the New Hampshire thing.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll move on to item number two, and these are options that the PDT, as they were developing the draft EIS, decided to present to the council as for possible inclusion into the document. The first one will take the two. There's two of these, and I'll take them separately. The first one addresses reporting requirements for federally permitted dealers, and there are three options that proposed measures under consideration in Amendment 14 for the mackerel FMP. And so as a result, I'd like to make a motion to include sub-options 2A, 2B, and 2C in Section 3.1.6.2 of the document. And if I can get a second, I'll give a brief, I'll speak to the motion a little bit.
Is there a second? Mark Gibson.
Thank you. As you'll see in the AP report, there was not a consensus on this. It was a very close vote, 5-4, 4-no. I'll just briefly read some of the comments that we had on this. There was concern about the feasibility of weighing fish for some dealers, support for including the option for further consideration and discussion, with the emphasis that the industry should support taking extra steps to ensure that we have the best information available. There was also some uncertainty related to the catch reporting, uncertainty if and how this related to the catch reporting is factored into the ACL process.
Okay, I will go to the audience for any comments on this motion. Seeing none, I will bring it back to the council. Discussion. Jim.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if this is exactly the right time to raise this, but probably close, and it's related to Rick Robbins' comments earlier about port sampling. And the center has considered this a bit, that it could be a cost-effective approach to monitoring the catch of non-target species such as river herring. So I believe that's not currently in the document, but I don't generally talk about what should go in or out of your documents, but I'm just reflecting the center's feelings. It seems consistent with what Rick Robbins mentioned about the recent FMET discussions related to mackerel. So consideration of port sampling as an approach.
Doug.
And just so the council's clear, this does not include port sampling. These sub-options include required dealers to annually document how composition of the mix of the catch is estimated. Another option would be require dealers to document how the composition of mixed catch is estimated for every landing submission, and require dealers to obtain vessel representative confirmation of the safest transaction recorded at first point of sale, just so that the vessel captains and the dealers are on the same page.
Further discussion? Pat?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is an option that the regional office with the PDT did spend considerable time developing, so I think reinserting it would be fairly easy at this point. And so I would make a motion to amend to reinsert section 3.6.3, measures to address port side sampling.
Is there a second to that? Sally McGee. Discussion on the motion to amend. Dave.
Just a process question. Where can somebody cite a page number? We kind of, is this in the document or is it
page
gone
80.
From the document?
Page 80.
3.6.3.
Dave Kaysen. Well, I got a lot of questions because I thought this was gone. It says it would require flow scales, so the flow scales would be back on A, B, and C vessels. I'm not clear whether it includes the states. I mean, the states had a monitoring system in place. We had some discussion of that. But I'm not sure whether I could support it or not because I'm not exactly sure what it does. And I need a description of what it's going to do and what, I mean, a lot of the portions of this I thought we kind of zeroed out. So I need a description from the service of what portions they actually plan to keep and what plans parts they don't plan to use.
Pat?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The previous section had more of a focus on verifying weights, and I think Jim's comment was to looking at verifying a bycatch, and so it would have to be revised and tailored to that goal and end. And so I'd ask Jim maybe to talk about what the Science Center's discussions were.
Well, I had an email exchange with Paul Rago, and he related to me that he felt that this from a that this wouldn't be a replacement for at-sea monitoring, but he felt that a port sampler would be an effective way to go through a landed catch and do subsampling to get a better estimate of the non-target species, such as haddock or river herring or other non-target species. And that's about all I know. I don't want to enter into the fray here, but I'm relating to you what Dr. Rago communicated to me.
Dave Pierce, then Terry Stockwell, and Doug.
You know, like David Gettle, I thought this was disposed of back in January of this year, and we did so, as noted on page 83 of the document, because of the service's concerns about the option. The removal of this option was prompted in part by concern from the service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, about the resources that were available to aid in the creation and running of a port site sampling program. It goes on from there and says that, it goes on from there. So I'm still unclear, Pat, as to why you would want this back in the document in light of the text that it seems to indicate that back in January you said it should not be in there because of funding concerns and other concerns related to it.
I think we're just reacting to the concern that this is the last opportunity to be able to consider this and that there was some feeling at the Science Center that this could be a useful addition to some of the other monitoring programs that we're looking at. Having said that, though, I realize there are a lot of unanswered questions here, and so I'm willing to withdraw the motion if the seconder is.
Again, we've had some debate without objection. Seeing none, consider that withdrawn. We're back on to the main motion. Further discussion. Terry, did you now want to? I have you on the list, and Doug. But
no, David, Made my point. Thank you.
Yeah, my point is moot now that it's been withdrawn. So,
further discussion on the main motion? I'll call the question. All those in favor so indicate. Contrary-minded? Abstention? Okay. So 16-0-0. And I think on the vote before, I may have said 17, but it was 16-0-0. We had one person away from the table. Doug?
The second item under recommendations from the PDT for possible inclusion includes some sub-options for the catch deductive and possible trip termination for slip events. And I'm going to make a motion to include sub-options 4B, 4C, and 4D in section 3.2.3.4 of the document.
Is there a second to that? Dave Gaethel. Okay, I will go to the audience. Any comments on this motion? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Cale, and I work with Lunds Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey. And is this the option on the additional trigger, the trigger clarification stuff that we talked about? I'm sorry.
Catch deduction and trip termination option.
Oh, yeah, okay. I wanted to speak against this one, too. So, yeah. This has been a long process, I think we all like to get this over and behind us, but the trip termination options just seem overly ambitious and very difficult to enforce, I would expect. It punishes people for the way the fishery operates. And I think that one of the good things about this process is it's brought a lot of data to the table. The PDT has done a lot of good work, and we're looking at the actual magnitude of so-called slippage or river herring bycatch, and I think it's a lot less than some of the advocates that aren't in the industry have been talking about for a long time. So we think that we're doing a really good job right now. This process has allowed the observer program to develop a lot of protocols also that we're using on the boats to make sure that the observer is seeing everything that is possible for them to see and so forth. I think that's working really well. So this just seems like a slap in the face, frankly, to the industry to terminate a trip for very small amounts of incidental catch. We have the lowest ratios or the best ratios in terms of kept and discarded of any fishery that you guys manage. So we don't like this approach, and we'd love to see it come out. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Rudolph with the Pew Environment Group. I want to speak in support of this motion and the inclusion of these new sub-options. I think these are sensible and reasonable fleshing out of some important provisions that were added to the document in January. I believe it was Dr. Pearson, Mr. Fair made the motion. The current template for accountability on dumping that's in operation in Closed Area 1 has several critical parts. It prohibits dumping of unsampled catch. However, it allows for some reasonable exceptions under which catch can be dumped without bringing it on board for the observers to sample it first. But then the critical third piece is that there's some accountability to prevent unnecessary utilization of those exceptions or abuse of those exceptions, some sort of a disincentive or a consequence for dumping. These are designed to provide some good options Trip termination was one potential consequence or disincentive that was in the document for a long time. It was taken out because it was viewed as too blunt a tool. This is a reasonable compromise that I refer to as the hybrid, in which there's an allowance for the fleet to dump a certain number of tows before trip termination would kick in. I think that the staff did a good job. My understanding is that Lori worked with the maker of the motion and even the staff down the Mid-Atlantic Council to try to flesh this out. I think they've done a good job. I think this provides for more synergy with similar measures in Amendment 14 down at the Mid for the squid mackerel butterfish plan, which is a good thing that everyone supports, as much consistency as possible between those two plans. And the last thing I would point out is that, again, I view these as a critical way to make sure there's options in the document that are as closely modeled on the current provisions in Closed Area 1 as possible. And the important thing for everybody to realize is that those measures in Closed Area 1 are working. They're working really well. The data is still coming in, but if you look in Framework 46 and you look in this document, you'll see that dumping on Georges Bank in the Area 3 herring fishery as a whole and in Closed Area 1 is way down in 2010 relative to prior years. I expect it'll go down again this year now that there's requirements to bring the operational discards on board. And I was just looking at Framework 46 back there. It looks like dumping in Closed Area 1 relative to the rest of the fishery for midwater trawlers was down 95% because of those new rules. And these measures are designed to make the document have measures more consistent with those rules. So as such, I support the motion. I encourage you to vote this in. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Steve?
My name is Steve Weiner, Choir Coalition, and longtime bluefin harpooner from Maine. This motion is a motion that we would support. It's been our objective from day one, our concern from day one. Choir's concern from day one has been accountability, monitoring, and dumping. It's important that this motion goes through and the public has an opportunity to comment. We've all spent a lot of time on this, and we would ask you to keep it in. Thank you.
Anyone else? Chris?
Hi. Chris Weiner, Choir, ABTA. I just wanted to follow up something that he said and just clarify for the council that what this is a motion or a measure you already had in the document, and that Lori and the PDT did a lot of good work to make it more workable. So what you're going to be doing if you vote against this is removing, basically you're going to be leaving something in that the PDT and Lori think isn't possible, and it'd be the only thing in there to deal with dumping. So if you remove this, you're going to be leaving only one thing to deal with dumping, and the PDT already said it wouldn't work. So I just keep that in mind, that this is, you know, the one thing in there you have to deal with it. And it's great to see the 2010 data. I'd remind you that a lot of that came from a program that was based on new rules that didn't allow dumping in a lot of areas. And I think it worked. That's, you know, I know someone already said that, but I would just encourage you to keep this in because, like I said, this is a measure, a set of measures that basically took what was in there and fixed it, or, you know, somewhat. So if you remove this, what you're basically is leaving one thing, and one thing that the PDT already said wouldn't work. So I would encourage you to keep it. Thank you.
Anyone else? Lori.
I just wanted to make sure everybody understands the options that as they're written and what we're talking about. And this is on pages 39 through 41 of the document. The original option is now labeled as option 4A, and as Chris mentioned, there are some concerns about the whether or not it is workable. I can't tell you for sure that any of the new options we proposed are ultimately going to be workable either, but we have tried to lay out some possible approaches that address some of the concerns with the original option. Now, what the original option proposes, it builds from the Closed Area 1 provisions, and if you see, as you can see, when you look at the closed area one provisions, which are on page 39 as well in the above section, there are three exceptions for slippage. One being safety, two being mechanical failure, three being dogfish. The option 4A, the original option, says that if one and two happen, safety or mechanical failure, there will be a 100,000-pound catch deduction, and after 10 slippage events, the vessel would be required to leave the management area. Now, my understanding after working through these options is that the intent there is to really discourage people from using safety and mechanical failure as reasons for slippage. But one of the problems that we were having is that nothing happens under that option if catch is slipped for bycatch reasons or for other reasons. So it's almost like if there's a safety reason, there's a deduction, but if there's a bycatch reason or something else, there's no deduction. And there are some legal concerns. We have some significant legal concerns that have been expressed associated with taking a catch deduction and potentially triggering accountability measures for catch that really may not have occurred or that we don't know if it occurred. What we do know from the data that we have is that slippage events tend to be far less than 100,000 pounds. So we tried to rework these. And the first thing that we did in option 4B is we added back in the closed area 1 provisions. In the original option, the closed area 1 provisions don't apply. It's just that if catch is slipped and it's a mechanical issue or a safety issue, the catch deduction occurs. So 4B, what we did is we added back in the closed area 1 provisions and sort of brought those two together so it made a little bit more sense. But it still only takes a catch deduction if it's a safety issue or mechanical failure. And the catch deduction is problematic. I'll let everybody know that now. The other problem with the catch deduction is if you look at the goals and objectives of this amendment, we're trying to improve catch monitoring and get better catch information. And it seems a little bit inconsistent to just randomly take a 100,000 pound catch deduction and end up with, you know, different data sets that show different catch amounts that we have to then sort through. I mean, it doesn't really necessarily enhance our ability to monitor the catch any better. That being aside, this is an issue dealing with bycatch and slippage, and that's another thing that we need to deal with in this amendment. So we felt, let's try to work these options, you know, in such a way that we deal with bycatch and slippage. So options C and D do not include the catch deduction. But the important thing about options C and D that you need to just make sure you're aware of, these options C and D are built from the Mid-Atlantic Council's amendment. And options C and D require trip termination, the closed area one sampling provisions, and trip termination after either 10 events or 5 events. There is no distinction in options C and D about why the slippage events may have occurred. So it's not just if there's gear or safety. It's all slippage events in options C and D. If slippage events incur for any reason after 10 of them, trip termination kicks in. And under option D, after 5 of them, trip termination kicks in. I just want to make sure everybody's clear because the options, they look very similar, but they're quite different. And there's a good range here. So, you know, our hope is that at least one of them is workable if this is the way the council wants to go. I will just again emphasize, though, that the catch deduction is a pretty significant concern, both from a legal perspective and from the technical perspective.
Laura, and then Mary Beth.
I'm going to go with the forgive the rookie that Tom went with yesterday. Having not been involved before and just looking at the 2010 numbers as the members that just came up to the microphone earlier spoke to that it seems to be that their management measures are working and slippage events are far down from where they've been prior, it would seem that perhaps what the management measures are in place right now are working. Do we need to layer on more? Would be my question, and I'm not even sure who to direct that to. Where the need is to layer on another set, if we're doing well in the fishery at the moment.
I think I would take that as a comment rather than a question that might be have a specific answer to it. Mary Beth.
I appreciate the thought that the PDT put into this section. However, it does seem that the original alternative is inconsistent with National Standard 1. We spent I think it's 10, Safety at Sea. We spent a lot of time developing the Closed Area 1 rules, and there were reasons why the different exceptions are in place. And we certainly don't want to compromise the decisions of a captain on a vessel when it comes to safety. So that's why they're in there. So then to turn around in this section and say, oh, but if you have something beyond your control that is safety-driven or mechanical, that you're going to, you know, penalize the industry. That just doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, that flies in the face of the Closed Area 1 rules and the rationale for what's in there. And then, you know, for the alternative C and D, it does away with the exemptions altogether and just says for any event, you know, there'll be the deduction and trip termination. So I just don't support any part. Lori's saying no. Just the termination and no deductions? Is that what it is? Okay, thanks. I don't know. The whole section just seems unnecessary to me, but... So in the end, I don't know that I support adding anything. Just subtract the whole thing. But
further discussion. Dave Pierce and then Sally McGee.
Yeah, I think that it has been very clear from previous meetings of the committee that the industry may be somewhat polarized on this issue. By industry, I mean those who are actually in the industry and those who are concerned about the industry's behavior. All sorts of claims have been made. I've been wrestling with this issue for a long time. I was the maker of the motion, the original motion. I still support it to go to public hearing. I would hate to take it out now. I would hate to not put it in. Recognizing that this is one of those hot-button issues, and it does deserve a lot of public discussion so that we can, when we come back to determine what we want to implement as part of this amendment, we'll be able to make those choices with all the information before us. Additional information regarding the concerns specific to legality, all the other considerations. So I would support keeping it in, well, including it, support including it because it will generate, I think, some rather interesting and useful discussion during the public hearings.
Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the motion. It's consistent with all of the objectives of the amendment. All of the options that would be put in through this motion have potential. They may need some additional work with the exception of, I guess it's option B, which is already in place, as Laura noted. But the other thing I just want to note is that this is not a layering on. This would be using a measure that appears to be working in Closed Area 1 and using that same approach in other areas. They're not perfect, but they need to be put out to the public so that we can make sure that we actually do have options that will meet the objectives of the amendment. Thank you.
Anyone else from the council? Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to note that to the extent that these options are essentially similar to a set of options that's also in Amendment 14, that we would, or that these options would benefit, I think, from public review and comment as we look forward again to trying to
at least preserve opportunities for compatible management down the road. Thank you.
Dave Gason.
Yes, I seconded this for discussion, and we're having a good discussion. I will say in advance here that I'm deeply concerned about the 100,000-pound deduction. As a guy who has a 10,000-pound boat, I could build up some great catch history here pretty fast by going out and dumping the net a few times with an observer on board at 100,000 a crack. Everybody laughs, but, you know, people think that way in this era of sectors and catch history and everything else. So, I have a real problem with that aspect of it. I don't think you can assign an arbitrary number to an event. So I probably won't support that in the final document. In fact, I know I won't support it. But I am interested in getting the public's comment on some of the other aspects of these motions. So I will vote to put it in the document.
Anyone else? Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you. I've been listening very carefully to this conversation. I think Rick Robinson's point and Dave Gaffler's points are well made. It's too early in the process to remove these options. We need more input on it. There are clearly good arguments on both sides, and I will support this motion and to send it out to public hearing.
Rodney.
Yeah, I'm concerned with the safety aspect of it. I will support the motion to go out to public hearing, but I have some concerns with penalizing a captain to keep his boat safe. We go back to the closed area with the scallop, same thing. But for public hearing, I will support keeping it in the document.
Anyone who hasn't spoken on it? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion, so indicate. Against, abstention, so 16-0-0. Doug.
So we're on to item number 3, which is on page 30 of the decision document. Before I make a motion for approval of the draft EIS for submission, I would just like to ask the council if there's any other issues that they'd like, either clarification, additional information, analysis, unfinished sections.
Dave Gaith.
Would this be the part where we address issues in the document, you know, add motions, or is that your desire here, Doug? Okay, I got a list. I'm going to start with section 3.1.4.2, the pre-trip notification system, and I'll make a motion to reduce the time from 72 to 48 hours.
Do we have a second to that motion?
I'll just second it for discussion purposes.
Doug Grout. Discussion.
Okay, well, the reason I make this motion is that currently in Groundfish it's 48 hours. Since you've got A, B, C, and D boats in this program, a lot of these are day boats. I mean, she's setting a time limit for notifying the observers of 3 days in advance. You can't. The accuracy of the weather service at 3 days is essentially zero. 48 hours is too long. I think it should be 12 myself. But at least this would make it consistent with the groundfish plan.
Gene, just a question. If it went out to public hearing at 72 hours, is 48 or 12 considered less restrictive?
Yeah, but that, as I always say, just because it's less restrictive doesn't mean that it's not an issue. If you want to get a full range of comments on something less than 72 hours and you're seriously considering that, then I suggest that that's how it be worded in the document.
Thank you. I'll go to the audience. Any comments on this? Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Libby, Port Clyde, Maine. I'm a ground fisherman, so I do this pre-trip notification all the time. And 48 hours is more than enough time. Most of the time we call in 48 hours ahead of time, and we don't hear back from an observer till 12 hours or so before the trip, like David said. And it's really, 24 is plenty of time, but 48 is way plenty of time. You're probably not going to know whether, if there's an option of being selected like there is in ground fishing, you're probably not going to know whether you're selected till between 12 and 1 hour of your trip. A lot of times I've been notified just 6 hours before the trip that someone's coming with me, so I think 72 is excessive. 48 is plenty of time. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else? Back to the council. Doug.
Just a quick question for Laurie. Do you remember why we set 72 hours? I was looking through the document, at least the option right here, and I couldn't see anything quickly. Do you?
Rodney.
Yeah, I might be corrected, but I believe the 72 hours was to give the observer a chance to get to some of the remote ports.
Anyone else? Call the question. Frank, I'm leaving.
Yeah, I think that I thought 48 was pretty good, but my recollection from AIMEE and Observer Program is just that in some of the remote ports, the 72, the 3 days is really needed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. It's not just a matter of contacting the PTNS system or calling. The observer providers need to be contacted. They need to ensure that there's an observer available. There's a lot that goes on. And certainly 12 or 24 hours is not enough. And the 72 is a good amount of time. If you want to put in the document 48 and we can have some comment on it, I don't see a problem with that. But going below 48 is, I don't think, is a feasible thing to do.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor so indicate. Thirteen in favor, opposed? Abstention?
One.
So 13-1-1. Motion carries. Dave?
Okay, I got a couple more.
Can any of these be grouped, or do you think? Or
no, they're in different sections. This would be a motion to modify section 3.3.3.2. To exempt vessels fishing under the small mesh northern shrimp fishery exemption with a fin fish excluder device as described in 50 CFR 648.80 from the closed area provisions in that section.
Are you seconding it, Terry? Okay. Terry Stockwell, discussion. Oh, excuse me, I'm going to go to the audience. Any comments? Gary?
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. I'm a shrimp fisherman. I support this motion. With our fin fish excluded device, there is some bycatch, but very, very low of all species. And I think an exemption is a fine idea. Thanks.
Anyone else? Back to the council. I'm going to start at Dave Pierce, Dave Gaethel, Mary Beth, and Terry.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've looked at data from the shrimp fishery that uses the finfish excluder device. I guess I'm asking if there are any data that would actually indicate that that the river herring would not pass through the bars of the device and be retained. So, again, I'm not sure whether I could I vote for this because I don't have data before me to indicate whether it's warranted to provide this exception.
Dave Gaethel.
I need to add to make this correct. I need to add a 1 after the 2, so it'll be 3.3.3.2.1.
Mary Beth.
Can someone direct me to the page number for this?
Like a 62.
And so is this referring then to all the river herring? Or is it just, I'm sorry, I'm a little confused on what we're
Laurie.
Doing.
Well, this is, section 3.3.3.2 are the options for protection areas. Now, the clarification that David just made would exempt the shrimp vessels only under option 1, which is the closed areas, but I'm thinking that you probably intend to apply the exemption to all of the options in 3.3.3.2. Because option 2 is trigger-based closed areas, which just means that if the catch trigger is hit, then the areas would close. So I'm assuming that your intent would be to apply the exemption to all of the options in 3.3.3.2.
Right. I have another motion after this one for another section.
Okay. So this motion, you're talking specifically about option 1. 3.3.3.2.1.
That's correct.
Mary Beth, then I've got Terry, then Mark, then Doug.
Well, thank you for that clarification. Just a little uncertain if this is appropriate to do at this particular time. I think it might be more appropriate to see if the PDT could include some analysis so we have something to look at before we decide whether we exempt them. Certainly there is herring bycatch in the shrimp fishery, and in some years it's quite significant. We had a request in the state of Maine to allow them to possess, retain, and sell it as bait because they had such interactions. So I don't think there should be an assumption because you have an excluder device that you don't have any interactions. I'm not clear on the implications to that fishery. I'm not clear on what we're doing here, and it's the first time it's come up. And so I think just excluding them today is inappropriate. What might be more appropriate to ask for more information so that or provide information in the public hearings. I'm not comfortable with the exclusion.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. David referred to several other sections where this motion would be applicable, but I do agree with Mary Beth's approach that this should be an issue for the PDT to analyze, and I'm not sure how the best way to incorporate it into the amendment is, but I guess it would come under some of the unfinished business that we have to deal with as we pull together the document. But the finfish excluders work very well, but as Mary Beth said, they're not perfect, and particularly at some times of the year. So I think this, you know, I don't know if this motion is what we need to have the discussion within the PDT, and if so, I will support it.
Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm opposed to the motion. I don't think we should be removing any river herring protection off and lacking in an evidence basis to do it. And I haven't seen any information to suggest there isn't any bycatch of river herring in this fishery.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support this motion because there is a finfish excluded device in here, and it has allowed a fishery to occur because of the tremendous reduction in the bycatch that has occurred. I think including this as an exemption in the off in the amendment will trigger or should trigger an analysis of the impacts of this, looking at the observer data to provide that kind of information in the draft EIS, so that at the time we make a decision on which measures to approve, we could potentially remove this if it's shown that there's a large, you know, a significant amount of river herring bycatch. But without this being in here, we're not going to have the analysis to look at it. As I said, I strongly suspect that you're going to find very little river herring bycatch in those particular areas that are the protected areas. And secondly, to Lori's question about whether they apply to other parts of the protectionary measures, the only other thing that I saw in there was that we have an option for a trigger-based closure, which if the trigger is, as I understand it, is triggered, it puts in place the protection area, which would have those, you know, the potential exemptions, for example, the 5.5-inch mesh, which we already have in there, is something that's exempted. So I think given the fact that these shrimp fishermen fish during the winter time primarily, and the fact that they already have a fish excluded device, the intent is to get bycatch out of that shrimp fishery, and it has made it a remarkably clean fishery right now. Having this option in here will trigger the analysis to so that the council can make a decision about whether this needs to be included. Pat?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I agree that this is premature to remove, and I'm going to oppose the motion.
Glenn?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I support the motion, but there is information out there that shows how these things perform, the fish excluder device, and they have to be rigged properly in order for them to eliminate most of the herring. I think Maine DMR has data. I know GMRI did a survey on bycatch, and I know from experience, I don't know if this data is quantified, but I know DMR did work with, I think it's called a non-parallel grate, where there's two different bar spacings. It does eliminate herring. I don't know if that was part of the survey. And the other thing that was used in that work was square mesh ahead of the cod end. So, and the hole has to be on top in the grate. If you put all those three things together, you're not going to catch hardly any herring. Hopefully there's enough data out there that the council will have it to look at and for consideration. Thank you.
Anyone else? Call the question. All those in favor, so indicate.
One, two, three, four, five.
Six in favor. Opposed? Ten opposed. Abstention? None. The motion fails. 6-10-0. Mr. Gatham.
Got one more. Modify section 3.3.2.2, the entire section, to exempt vessels fishing under the small mesh northern shrimp fishery exemption with a fin fish excluded device as described in 50 CFR 648.8, or vessels fishing with mesh greater than 5.5-inch from the provisions under options 1 and 2 in this section.
Is there a second to that? Doug? A Casson first. Okay, we go to the audience discussion. Back to I'm going to go with Tom. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. I apologize if I'm missing something here, but is this meant to address the river herring closures as similar to the previous motion? And if so, should it be 3.3.3.2? I don't even know, Lori, is there a 3.3.2.2?
Yes, it's the monitoring and avoidance.
Oh, monitoring and avoidance. Okay. If that's the intention, I apologize for the question. I think that's probably correct then. Thanks.
Gary, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Libby. I support the motion. If we need someone to come out on boats and collect some data so you guys can see the small amounts of bycatch that I get, because I have a Nodmore great that's size sorting or double grid. We let the real small shrimp out. Small little fish. Got it rigged with a hole on top. Got the square mesh. The square mesh is something a lot of fishermen have done voluntarily. That's not mandatory. In the state of Maine, state of Maine law says when you're shrimp fishing, you only retain shrimp, so no one targets any other species. We do our best just to catch shrimp, and anything that we can do to exempt affecting the shrimp fishery for the short time that it's operated in the winter, I'm in favor of. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, I think we need to get the motion up.
Yeah, can we just have written. Him reread the motion?
It's got a few blanks up there, question marks.
Okay. Yeah, that's why I have my hand up. Okay, the first part's right. You get to 648.8 or vessels fishing with mesh greater than 5.5 inches from the provisions under options 1 and 2 in this section. I got to keep switching glasses here to read the board. The motion reads correctly now. And could I speak to the motion, or?
You may.
Okay, one of the things that people may have overlooked here in this section is that there's no exemption for larger mesh here. If this trigger is reached, you shut down to all fishing as it's currently written. It seems a little foolish to have the groundfish fishery shut down by this trigger. So there's a reason for this.
Okay, I have Mary Beth and Tom Dempsey.
Well, I guess that's what I'm struggling with, is what the reason for this is. I thought this applied specifically to herring vessels and had absolutely nothing to do with groundfish. I mean, I was just thinking, is this trying to allow some vessels that have herring permits that might be fishing for something else to keep herring and be exempt from these rules? I don't see what it has to do with you know, large mesh groundfish. Lori, could you interpret this for us? I mean, these closures or triggers, I didn't think they had anything to do with groundfish. Am I missing something?
Well, first of all, we're in the section on monitoring and avoidance, so we're not in the section on closures. So this motion doesn't speak to the options that would close anything. These are areas where additional monitoring, perhaps closed area 1 provisions, perhaps observer coverage, or something like that would be required. There are no exemptions right now in the document, and the council had determined that these options could end up applying to all herring permit holders, including Category D, which is the open access fleet. So right now, and these are, this is on page 48 of the document, 100% observer coverage in these areas, closed area one sampling provisions is the other option, and there are sub-options that would apply them to just the limited access herring vessels when on a declared herring trip, or all herring vessels, including the 2200 Category D vessels. At this point, there are no exemptions. The maps are in the previous pages in terms of the areas that these measures would apply to. So right now, those are the options that are in front of you. So, yeah, it could apply to a vessel that's not going out herring fishing at all if that vessel has a herring permit, and if this council determines that all herring vessels should be subject to the rules.
Dave, Jim, and then Dave.
But if we, if my understanding, Lori, and your, just your explanation now, if sub-option B was picked, then this only applies to vessel herring vessels when they're declared on a herring trip. So the other vessels, the large mesh vessels and the shrimp vessels, would not be. So this is almost redundant to sub-option B.
No, sub-option B says it would apply to those vessels when they're on a declared herring trip, right, as well as any Category D vessels that go into the area. Sub-option B on page 48 brings in the whole Category D fleet as well.
Tom, and then Dave Gaethel.
My comment's pretty similar to Jim's. I think it's on declared herring trips. I think sub-option A, under the 100% observer alternatives, option one, covers this, because you'd either be on a herring trip, a declared herring trip, in one of the limited access groups, or you wouldn't be impacted. And then in the second, in option two, applying the closed area one sampling provisions, both options C, I guess it's sub-option C, is similar in that way, that it wouldn't apply, I think, to this group of vessels fishing it in this way.
Dave.
Well, maybe it's a difference in language, but the way I read this, it says to ensure 100% coverage, all herring vessels would be prohibited from fishing in river herring monitoring and avoidance areas without a NIMS approved observer on board. If you have a herring permit, you're gonna need an observer. And whether you're fishing for herring or not. And you know, again, this is an artifact of dragging all these C&D boats in here that are doing something else. I do think you need this motion in order to specifically say that when boats and, you know, when these boats are doing these two things, they do not need 100% observer coverage.
Mary Beth?
So, just for some clarification, perhaps from Lori, I noticed she had her hand up. Maybe it is the way we're reading it, but the way I read it, I agree with Tom that the options are there. It should be limited to vessels on a declared herring trip, not vessels, and I believe that it's there as well as one that's more inclusive. I think we're good, but maybe Lori could correct me.
Well, yes, sub-option A is just the A, B, and C vessels. There's no D vessels involved. So the limited access fleet is going to have to, they use the pre-trip notification system, they use the VMS to declare in and out of the fishery. So looking at option one here, the 100% observer coverage option, sub-option A would just be for limited access herring vessels when on a declared herring trip. Now, shrimp vessels that have limited access permits, which I bet a lot of the shrimp vessels have C permits, would most likely, when they go shrimp fishing, are going to declare into the herring fishery if they, because they will be in violation if they possess one herring, if they don't declare into the fishery. So maybe they don't, but My assumption is that they would declare into the fishery so that if they encounter herring, they don't have to discard it. If that's not the case, then, again, maybe we don't have a problem there, but under sub-option A, it's the A, B, and C boats that are on a declared herring trip. You have to be on a declared herring trip if you're going to have a herring on your boat. Sub-option B brings in the open access fleet. Those are the two choices you have at this point. No exemptions are considered at this point, so I guess I'm not clear on whether or not there needs to be an exemption for the shrimp fishery. My assumption was that the shrimp fishery catches herring sometimes, but that's something, obviously, if this motion passes, that we would have to look into. One other comment, if people are uncomfortable with this approach, depending on how this motion goes, you may want to consider directing the PDT to add some sort of analysis in the document that looks at some particular fisheries for consideration for exemptions during final decision making.
Mary Beth, last shot.
My understanding for the shrimp fishery, not a shrimp fisherman, we do have one at the table, is that to operate in the shrimp fishery using small mesh, you have to have a letter of authorization to operate in the large mesh area, and that prohibits the retention of herring.
Dave Gates.
There's no letter for shrimping. You declare out a fishery for shrimping, but and you're not allowed to possess herring. But like Lori said, you got one on board. You know, it's underneath the rail or something. There's a lot of issues here that people haven't thought out. Zero, as far as enforcement is concerned, zero means zero. It doesn't mean one, two. It means zero. The second part of this is the large mesh. Currently, you're on a groundfish trip. You're allowed to keep herring. You're allowed to keep anything on a groundfish trip. But again, if these things are triggered, and your crew's set aside a couple of herring to use for bait or something, you're in violation. So all this is saying is that in these two specific instances, we're not going to enforce 100% observer coverage because these aren't the places where the river herring are occurring.
Frank. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'm reading up sub-option B here, too, saying that any vessel, it's not just a groundfish vessel, 5.5, I think that's the flounder mesh size. That's what I think where that came from, or summer flounder. So the way I read it is anybody with possession of one herring would have to have 100% observer coverage on B. And I think we had a lot of discussion in the committee on this, and I don't remember that being the intent. If you were on a D vessel using large mesh, I think we were trying to avoid having 100%. That's my recollection.
Doug, then Rodney.
Yes, I support this motion, and it is trying to get at, trying to refine this option, as the previous motion did, to get at where there potentially is some river herring bycatch. We've already made an exemption under the protected area for vessels fishing with 5.5-inch mesh. This exact group of people, the D permit holders that may have a open access herring permit on them, clearly with a 5.5-inch mesh, unless you plug your net, you're not going to get much river herring. This also opens up a tremendous increase in the amount of observer coverage that would have to be provided. And the cost of these vessels that are not directing at herring and are unlikely to catch significant amounts of river herring because of either the mesh size or the fact that they're using a finfish excluder device, I think this is a very important exemption that we need to put in here, if not for any reason other than to have the analysis done. But I think it's not where we were trying to get at with the trying to limit the river herring bycatch here. It's not the fishery we were trying to direct at because they don't have that much river herring bycatch.
Rodney?
Yeah, Doug made some of the points I was going to make, so same thing.
Anyone who hasn't spoken on this? Call the question. All those in favor of the motion, so indicate. 12 in favor. Opposed? 4 opposed. Abstention? 1. 12, 4, 1. The motion carries. Is there anything else? Back to you, Doug.
Just check if there's anybody on the council that has any other items they'd like to bring up before I make a motion to approve the draft EIS as amended today for submission for public hearing.
Rodney?
No,
Lori. Oh, Lori? I saw your hand up, so I thought it was you.
I have a couple issues. Just a couple of things that I would like a little bit of additional clarification on. First one being the closed area one provisions. And I'm going to go ahead and raise this because this is an issue that's been raised to me from some of the stakeholders over the past couple of days, and I'd like to get some clarification from the council. The closed area one provisions are proposed to apply in various sections of this document, and we've got it set up in the document that the closed area one provisions could apply in the river herring monitoring areas. That's one option. Or they could apply, and or they could apply in across all of the year-round groundfish closed areas. That's another option. There's another option that would apply them everywhere throughout the fishery. So what we've done is we've taken the closed area one provisions as they currently apply in closed area one and tried to translate them into these various sections of the document and keep the intent, the council's intent. But not everything translates perfectly when you go from a small area to larger areas and things like that. So what you see in the document right now is for the closed area one provisions, in the section for river herring where there's an option to apply them to the river herring monitoring areas, I'm pretty sure it's word for word, and that is that if there's a slippage event, the vessel would be required to fill out the released catch affidavit and leave the river herring monitoring area. In the year-round groundfish closed areas, I believe that also is the way that it's written. If there's a slippage event, the vessel would have to fill out the affidavit and leave the year-round groundfish closed area. In the section that applies the closed area one provisions throughout the entire fishery, that particular component is not there. If there is a slippage event, the closed area one provisions would apply full sampling. Everything has to come aboard the vessel for sampling. And if there's a slippage event, the released catch affidavit would have to be filled out. But we did not bring in the component that the vessel would have to leave the management area because that's just not feasible in some cases. Like that equates to trip termination. If you're talking about Area 1A and you're talking about a purse seine vessel and you apply the closed Area 1 provisions, which, by the way, we don't know how they're going to work on purse seine vessels because we have no experience with them applying them to purse seine vessels. But assuming they work and assuming that we implement them, if a purse seine vessel is fishing in Area 1A and is complying with the closed Area 1 provisions and a slippage event occurs, the vessel can't leave Area 1A and go fishing anywhere else. I mean, the trip's over because purse seine vessels don't fish anywhere else. Similarly, in Area 2, in the wintertime fishery, if a slippage event occurs, the vessel can't leave the area and go fishing somewhere else because that's where the fishery is. It's in Area 2. So it's trip termination. So we did not, in translating these regulations to apply across the entire fishery, we did not carry over that component of the closed Area 1 provisions. It's carried over in the river herring monitoring areas. It's carried over in the groundfish closed areas. just couldn't figure out. It was inconsistent with the council's vote to eliminate trip termination from the document, which kind of occurred at the same time that we developed these other measures. So I just want to make everybody clear on that. There was some concern expressed that the closed area one provisions weren't written correctly in the document. So I went back and looked, and that's the way they're written, and I still, from the PDT's perspective, I still support that, and I think it's consistent with the council's intent. But if that's not what the council intended, I'd like to get that clarified now in terms of how the closed area one provisions should apply across all the broader management areas. And then the second issue that you may or may not want to talk about, and that's fine, is the alternative for a maximized retention experimental fishery. I mean, this is still in the document. If there's any interest in simplifying things, you may want to just consider what to do about that. I can tell you right now there's really no way to analyze that, and if you look at the analysis, the one thing that's clear is that maximized retention, whether it's through an experimental fishery or through regulation, is ineffective without portside sampling. There's really no point in requiring vessels to bring everything back to the dock if it's not going to be sampled. And this catch composition isn't going to be determined and things like that. So that's something that could be clarified or simplified. I'm just putting it out there because this is a pretty complicated document. So those are the two things that I was looking for some clarification on. Thank you.
Mary Beth. And then Doug, sorry.
So just so I'm clear, for the closed area one provisions, in, when it applies to all areas, you just left out that part of leaving the area and everything else stays the same? So that seems like a reasonable approach of how to deal with that. And the only other thing I would note on that section is that not allowing for operational discards in the same fishery, bringing the net aboard, that's not possible. I mean, it just can't be done. And hopefully we'll get those comments through the public hearing process. But it's just not physically possible to bring a net with fish aboard, the purse seine through a block. It just is not happening.
Doug.
Yes, I just wanted to make a point concerning the closed area one provisions to the general area that at least is my recollection as committee chair. That we weren't going to have a trip termination provision in that particular that option because of the broad areas. Clearly, that's something that could be that should be and is already in the groundfish closed areas, and likely would be a potential measure that we should be considering for the river herring closed area. But from the broad area, it's not what we intended, at least from my. My recollection.
Anything else on this? Tom?
Just to that point, did the committee discuss, and I agree, in some places, as Laura discussed, the fishery is in a management area, and moving off that would be a trip termination. Was there any conversation at the committee level about a stat area, so leaving a stat area or moving off that? Because I think an important part of that closed area one and the success that we've seen in 2010, at least from what I've seen, has been that backstop of leaving the area. Was there any discussion about that?
Not at the statistical. No, it wasn't an option that I believe we discussed. You can correct me, but I don't have any recollection of that.
Dave Pierce.
Yeah, regarding this issue, the plan development team has correctly interpreted my intent, and I believe the committee's intent. The plan development team used some good judgment on this issue. Thank you.
Doug? You? Dave?
Yeah, just note, too, that depending on what options are picked here for the river herring, that it is trip termination for the whiting boats, because we got these little boxes that we're allowed to fish in, and the little boxes are in those boxes. So basically, if you know we have to leave the area, we got to go home. That's all there is. So you might want to analyze that too, because I'm looking at these alternatives off New Hampshire here, and that includes the entire area that you're allowed to fish.
Okay, if there's no other comments at this point, I'd like to make a motion to approve the draft EIS as amended today for submission in public hearings. Draft EIS for Amendment 5, excuse me.
So Dave Preble, seconder. Since it is a motion, anybody in the audience want to speak to that? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, I'm E.K. Khalsa. I'm the executive director of the Mystic River Watershed Association, and I'd like to speak very strongly in favor of the movement to approve this amendment, with acknowledgement to the tremendous amount of work that the council and all of the stakeholders have done to draft this document and prepare it for submission for public comment, and also to acknowledge the rigorous approach that you and all stakeholders are taking to this effort. The Mystic River Watershed is an area of the Metro Boston region which enjoyed a tremendous river herring migration for many, many centuries. And, of course, this area now sees a much, much, much reduced population of river herring. I simply wanted to point out as a comment that to complement the efforts that the council and the fishing industry is making to reduce and minimize herring bycatch, the communities of the Mystic River, as well as many other New England coastal communities, are making a tremendous effort to restore the habitat for river herring, certainly in the Mystic River. And the towns and cities of that area are preparing to spend a tremendous amount of money to help improve water quality, which will enhance and restore and protect the river herring habitat. So I'd like to speak on behalf of the association very strongly in favor of adoption of this amendment, and to say that our members and other associated environmental advocacy groups look forward to the opportunity to comment during the public comment period. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Yes, I'm George Comiskey. I'm with the Parker River Clean Water Association. And I'd also like to echo EK's support of moving this draft EIS forward. I think the graph behind me shows almost 40 years of river herring monitoring going on, and the results are pretty bleak. So any help this council can do in drafting amendments and alternatives would be extremely helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to belabor this. I know we all want to leave. You've been here all week, but I hope that the council members will join some of us at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute tonight at 7 o'clock, where Mike Armstrong from MassDMF will make his presentation, River Herring Smoking Gun. And his conclusions are that recruitment of river herring are largely environmental-driven, and I think if you analyze it that way, it's pretty clear. The data in this also is pretty clear, too. I think last year we caught, 16,000 pounds. Maine's got a directed fishery of 1 million pounds, for example. Our commercial fishery is not the reason why the river herring stocks have gone down from North Carolina up to Rhode Island, wherever. Some of the runs are in good condition. Our effort has declined dramatically, all of us out there, over the last number of years. And if you analyze what our contribution to mortality is, I think it's very low. So I invite you all to come up and listen to Mike later. It's a great presentation. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Herb.
I'm not going to oppose the motion. I would just make some comments for the benefit of other council members as we go through this process and get ready to come back, you know, a few months down the road to make final decisions. The one impression I have of the document, and I know that, you know, it's been a while since we had seen it, is how complicated it is. I've really struggled with just, you know, providing an explanation to fishermen of what's in the document and what it means. And I would urge everybody to think in terms of, you know, is there a way we can simplify it? Earlier in the week, we talked about simplifying regulations. We've had a report that tells us things are too complicated, and this document is way too complicated. So I would just encourage people to think about that.
Chairman Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our Squid Mackerel Butterfish Committee is scheduled to meet on Tuesday, October the 11th in Galloway, New Jersey, to review the findings of the FMAT that we've already discussed, formulate their recommendations in terms of alternatives to include in the DEIS for Amendment 14. The council will be voting on that, or considering that at least, for action on October the 12th. And as soon as that's done, I'll be sure that that's transmitted to you so that you can have that additional information and perhaps some follow-up discussion at the November meeting of this council. But we'll stay in close contact on that, and as I've already done, I would invite you, if you're able, to attend that meeting so that we can stay in close concert on this. And I don't know, you know, obviously what the outcome of that meeting will be, but to the extent that there may be alternatives that fall outside of the range of Amendment 5 alternatives, and to the extent that we're trying to achieve collaborative management of this issue, we'll stay in close contact, and we'll forward any output of that meeting directly to you as soon as it's complete. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Call a question. All those in favor, so indicate. Opposed? Abstention? 16-01. The motion carries. Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more item here, and that is I would like to ask the deliberative body here if they would like to select preferred alternatives in this document, either in some sections or all sections. We can it could be either one. As has been stated previously with some other amendments, that sometimes having preferred alternatives helps focus the public comment. And so I'd would appreciate hearing from the rest of my colleagues here if they would like to spend some time this afternoon going through selecting some alternatives, preferred alternatives.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the length of time that this document is taken to put together, the complexity of it, and the polarized opinions around the table and in the public, I'm not supportive of any preferred alternatives. I really want to hear what the public has to think, I think we'd be doing ourselves and the public a disservice by prioritizing or selecting any preferred alternatives at this time.
Thank you. I actually was just informed by council that we have, in fact, approved sending it out, and this would be having to go back and amend that, and essentially we may be done.
Sorry, that was my fault.
I guess I should have consulted with the council. Because I asked that same question and
yeah, I answered that one wrong. Sorry. I figured why bother selecting preferred alternatives if the document, if you didn't know if the document was going out, but okay.
Is there anything else, Doug?
No, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Is there any other business to come before us, 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 come before.